are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, July 13th, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks, and I am going to be joined momentarily by Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal and the American Federation of Teachers Conference in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in the two heartlands of America. On today's program, Sam is talking to a variety of really important and interesting guests at the Teachers Conference about union organizing, post-Janus, resistance in the fullest sense in the age of Trump, and maybe some hot takes on the Hillary Clinton speech that Sam was just live tweeting. Also, film guy Matthew joins us later on to give a film recommendation. Donald Trump is in the UK, and he's already, within a matter of hours, called his Sun interview, where he undercut Theresa May's Brexit position, fake news, even as he is doubling down on some of his most overt displays of racism in his political career of overt displays of racism, as London's Mayor Sadiq Khan calls his comments on terrorism preposterous, and protesters flood the streets, including with a very grotesque blimp that looks like our very grotesque president. Fiery hearings yesterday with FBI agent Peter Strzok on the Russia probe, with Republicans trying to destroy and gut his credibility and Democrats attempting to re-anchor the process and get to some actual answers. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. If we're ready, we will throw now to Pittsburgh to Samantha Steeder.
That's right, folks. I am here. You know, I'm in, I don't know the name of this convention hall, but I am overlooking one of the rivers, of the three rivers in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Matt, could you turn down that music? I still have playing in my ear. I'm not sure if that's going out. And I am at the National AFT Convention. American Federation of Teachers. There's also UFT, which is the New York version of the AFT. There's a lot of members there. And AFT represents other folks alongside of teachers. I'll get the specific details, but it's primarily a teachers union. And there are two major teacher unions in the country, the NEA and the AFT, and broadly speaking, the NEA started off as more of a professional association that was teaching teachers to be better teachers, and the AFT started off as a union that was more associated with the union movement, and over time, the NEA has come to do collective bargaining. Now, of course, that was before 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, with the Janus decision, when essentially federal workers became to live under federal right to work laws. Now, state to state, that may be different, and I'm going to I'm going to ask Randy Weingarten about some of the specifics and the implications of this, but what this means, broadly speaking, is that unions can no longer compel, because it is also the law in a lot of these places, that there is collective bargaining and that the union must represent everyone in the shop. Now, it used to be you didn't have to join the union, but you still had to pay what is known as agency fees. Agency fees are fees that basically require you to pay the cost of having lawyers negotiating contracts and having an apparatus to make sure that disputes are resolved over the course of a contract, et cetera, et cetera. No longer can those payments be compelled because of this right-wing Supreme Court overturning a 40-year precedent set in the 1977 Abood versus Detroit case. And so that's where we are. And so the big question is going to be for unions like this one, what is the answer to this? How are they going to respond to this new environment? And one of the answers may lie in the series of strikes that we saw just months ago, really, in places like Oklahoma and West Virginia, other states across the country, where I'm hoping, and some of the program's going long right now, but I'm hoping to have here the president of the Oklahoma City AFT, who was one of the leaders of the strikes in Oklahoma. Same to Fred Albert, the president of the AFT Kanawha, West Virginia. Hopefully I'm going to be talking to Callie Leba, president of Douglas County, Colorado Federation. We shall see, hopefully, and I'm going to be talking to some other folks who are doing other programs across the country, and then later in the program, Randy Weingarten, the president of the AFT, will be sitting down with me, and I'll be asking her a series of questions. In the meantime, let me just, I mentioned this a while back, and Michael, I know you probably bought a bunch of prints, but other people may not have. My sister started a fundraiser. She is a photographer and an artist, but she works in the medium of photography. I don't want to get that wrong. She basically set up a fundraiser with a lot of well-known photographers and artists. And you can go to Make the Wave 2018, Make the Wave, as in, hey, make a blue wave, take back the House, and hopefully the Senate. That would be nice.
Yeah.
MakeTheWave2018.com. They're selling photographic prints for $100. And
we got them up on screen. They look great. Really?
Yeah, it's a great deal. They're I don't know. Not everybody has $100 to spend right on a piece of art. But if you do, there's some great art and it goes to a good cause. And I will say this, you know, Kavanaugh seems to I have not read too deeply into the whole thing about the $200,000 worth of baseball tickets that he bought for his friends. Have you read about this, Michael?
No.
Yeah, it has.
But I like the sound of it.
Well, it has not gotten the attention, and I think it needs. I think there needs to be. I need to read more into this. I don't want to make more of it than is there, but it's rather strange.
I mean, we said right out of the gate that the real focus on him has to be on some type of conflict of interest, potential, ethics questions.
Process,
so this is great.
Exactly.
Process and
process
ethics.
Stuff. Right. Yeah. Exactly.
So this is good.
And this is one of those things where you can imagine, because look, I just saw, it was interesting. This morning, I read a piece in Politico that was about how none of the moderates, so-called moderates, right? The Manchins, the conservatives, and the
right-wing Democrats.
The right-wing Democrats. They're all like, Chuck knows better than to come and tell me how to vote. He can't whip me. You know, Joe Manchin said something like, I'm 71 years old. I'm not going to get whipped on this vote, or whatever it is.
Oh, my God.
Now, when I read this in Politico, from my perspective, whenever I read something in Politico, the first thing you have to ask yourself is, who put this piece there?
Right.
Right? Like, Politico is, it's all just like a series of beet sweeteners.
Right.
And in some respect, it is, it's helpful because
it's an industry rag.
It's an industry rag, but it's also, it's sort of like, you get a sense of like, who wants what message out there?
Right.
Now, this seems to be just like a story, but this is a story that I would imagine someone like Chuck Schumer's office would be putting out. Like, I have no control over these people. And it may be the case that he doesn't. But what Chuck Schumer does have the ability to do is to go out there and use what little leverage he has in terms of when he speaks about this stuff, they're going to put a camera on him to create essentially the cover, if you will, for these members of his caucus to vote against Kavanaugh. These are all people who voted for Gorsuch. He shouldn't have allowed that. Obviously, he can't tell them what to do, or he can, and they won't necessarily listen to him. But a good leader would have had the ability to sort of corral these people, figured out which votes I can give them, which votes I want to keep for me, et cetera, et cetera. But all that aside, this is why stuff like this is important. Because now look, it is very hard for me to imagine a scenario where a guy who makes what Kavanaugh does, a couple $100,000 a year, I guess maybe he had a time where he made a little bit more. I haven't read into his financial disclosures. But there are things that seem a little bit weird. Fronting your friends $200,000 worth of baseball tickets seems like a weird thing to do. Right. And then having it all pay it off very shortly around the time that you were put on the short list in 2017 for future judicial nominations seems also weird.
Yeah.
And this is also something that, like, look, is there anybody out there in the country who would argue that someone who gets into arrears of $200,000, let's say, I mean, look, for me, and this is, of course, is complete speculation, complete conjecture on my part, it is very possible that he is super friendly, that none of his friends have the ability to buy tickets. They only have the ability to pay him back in large chunks of $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 at a time.
That's how it works.
But they don't have credit cards, right? Like, I mean, we all have friends like that, right?
I have a lot of friends in a very specific trade that keep cash in shoeboxes and don't have credit cards. And I'm sure Judge Kavanaugh does as well.
Of course, of course. We all have friends
who
don't have a credit card but have the ability to write you a check for $20,000 once they get paid.
Right.
Or something like that.
Or a deal goes through, if you know what I'm saying.
Right. Now, but let me just for a moment be a little bit loosey-goosey here. I hope people will forgive me, right? Because this is, I'm like entering into the realm of speculation, and, I'm not some type of forensic accountant. I'm not a psychologist. I don't know. But I will say this. I have in my own personal life experienced people with gambling problems. And one of the telltale signs of gambling problems is that they rack up a lot of debt. And regardless of how much money they have, they rack up a lot of debt. Now, so I'm not saying that Kavanaugh does. I have no idea. But let's just say hypothetically, you had a Supreme Court nominee who had a gambling problem that was at least established enough that he would get $200,000 debt and somebody had to come in and pay it off. This, to me, seems like contrary to the judicial temperament we want in a Supreme Court justice.
I would say also, regardless of your ideology, regardless of where you come down on judicial philosophy, it just doesn't seem to me a prudent choice.
It's not. I mean, honestly, we need someone with strong character,
right?
Someone who has integrity, someone who cannot be blackmailed.
Precisely.
Right? I mean, because, you know, if you have that type of gambling problem, that leads to a lot of other potential problems. That's all I'm saying. Chuck Schumer should be out there saying, like, I'm going to need answers. because, you know, when I go to the Mets game, I buy my own ticket.
And I don't go to the Baileys are very concerned about this.
The Baileys, the Baileys have never lent their friends $200,000 fronting them for the tickets.
I asked them yesterday in my theater of the mind, which I take 3 hours in the afternoon to do. Do you guys have a couple $100,000 of cash laying around to lend to your friends so they can give you money later, even though they don't have credit cards? And they said, no, that doesn't happen to Massapequa.
And let's be honest, too. If we take him at face value that he fronted his friends $200,000 worth of tickets, like, I would also say, like, you're a judge. I don't think that shows too good a judgment. Like, I mean, if my friend came to me and said, like, listen, I need $20,000. And I don't have any credit. Can you take out a loan? Because I need to get an operation that is going to save my life. I would be like, yeah, I'll do it. I'll take out that loan. I'll take out a loan for as much as I can take out. Because your life depends on it.
Right.
But the urgency involved in going to see a Nationals baseball game?
I do the distinction there. Like, yeah, like, if a story got leaked, and it would be utterly irrelevant. But if it was like the guy took out a loan to save his friend's life, you'd be like, okay, so he's a personally nice
guy.
And judicially, he's a terror. But this is right. That is funny. Like, I am in a emergency need to see the Nationals situation.
I feel like if I did that,
yeah.
Like, okay, listen, everybody, I just want to be on up front. I'm 200 grand in the hole because I had to front my friends some Red Sox tickets, but it's going to be fine. I feel like if we had members of the audience going, I can't trust Sam's judgment. I don't think I'm going to listen to this show anymore. I feel like that would be a rational response.
Side note, bummer for you, Matt, because this was your Nets season tickets plan.
Well, I was going to say Bryce Harper's hitting well this year.
All right, listen.
You got a guest?
I got a guest.
All right.
And I think we got to go. Michael Vamp for a moment. And
all right. We're not sure. Yeah, I think, though, that just to underline what we've been saying, I mean, obviously, it's really important to find whatever the sort of pressure points there are to potentially, you know, get Manchin, Heidkamp, Doug Jones in the right column. And then what's funny is that paradoxically, I mean, the process and the judicial temperament stuff matters across the board, but in a funny way, the overturning Roe or the attack on women's health and reproductive rights in some ways will be much more relevant for Collins and Murkowski that's their branding.
Heidkamp,
but as far as the right-wing Democrats go, it's judicial process.
Heidkamp is down by like 6 in a poll, and which that might be not. North Dakota has bad polling.
Right.
But if this becomes about abortion, that's not going to be good for her.
No, I mean, Heidkamp's a big, big problem, but it's process for the right-wing Democrats, abortion for the two supposedly pro-choice Republicans. You ready, Sam?
Yeah, and let me just, to finish that up, you know, the point being that if Kavanaugh can be tied up because of the judgment expressed by lending his friends 200 grand to buy baseball tickets, there is opportunities for, you know, who knows? Democrats take the Senate and then it's a totally different ball game.
To think they really might. But anyways, go ahead.
Well, yeah. It's look, at the very least, it's conceivable.
Well, that's what it is. It feels to me now like it's a legitimate thing to say could happen. Yeah.
Okay, so joining me now from the AFT convention in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and Callie, if you could just get right up in there. Yeah. Okay. Do you want to just come in a little bit this way, Matt? Okay. You just head. Actually, slide your chair down that way. Just like this. That would be great. Okay. That's great. Okay. And all right. So forgive us, folks, because we're just doing this on the fly. But with me now is Callie Leyba. She is the president of Douglas County, Colorado
Federation.
So that is the local chapter of the AFT.
Correct.
And all right. So you guys had an interesting, spring.
We did. We were inspired by the West Virginia teachers' strike. We walked out and closed our school district along with I don't know how many other districts in the state that took to the Capitol and marched around the Capitol to talk to our legislators about school funding. Unfortunately, in Colorado, our legislators can't raise taxes. It's up to the voters to do that. But it was a way to raise attention to the funding problems we have and how it's hurting our students in Colorado.
Okay, so give me a sense of like what were the issue sets. Give me a sense of what teacher pay is like there. What? Give me a little bit of background as to the situation in Colorado, and go with that, and then I've got some other questions.
Okay, Colorado has a really booming economy, and I don't have any of the numbers on top of my head right now, but we're doing really, really well
Pot.
In Colorado. Well, that's actually a big myth. So if you got a 1% raise, would that really change your life? Not really. And that's about what the pot money does for our general fund.
Okay.
So the pot money hasn't helped, but it has caused voters to think that schools are doing great because we have pot money.
Interesting.
So
is this pot money supposed to go to specifically for schools?
Yeah, there it's through a grant, the BEST grant, and so it helps with only capital improvements and mostly for some of our rural districts that really need the help. So they may get a grant that will get a new roof for one of their schools in a year. It's not a ton of money.
Okay.
We have a crazy tax law that has caused our property taxes to go down. So we pay on about 7.8% of our house. So basically you pay on a dining room and that's the only part of your house that's taxed.
Wow.
So our money for schools has gone down and down and down while our economy is doing better, but we can't raise taxes without the voters. So we actually just yesterday, the day before, submitted petition signatures to get an initiative on the ballot to raise education funding. So
how did it come about that you decided to do a walkout? How long did it last? I mean, and give me a sense of what you guys are doing day in, day out as a union that maybe lays the foundation for those type of situations.
Well, I'll try to be brief. It's a
Don't be brief.
Okay. So back in 2009, our school district, Douglas County, Colorado, and Douglas County is a really wealthy county. I think it's like the fifth wealthiest in the nation. We had some political reformers like Betsy DeVos type people come in and take over our school district through winning some school board races. And so for the past 8 years, we've been in a takeover and a fight for our lives, really. Koch brothers have been involved, and all the big names coming in and funding these school board candidates.
And so what are these school board candidates doing? Charters?
Charters.
Vouchers?
Vouchers. They created a voucher program that went all the way to the Supreme Court. And it was unique because in Douglas County, we're not your typical urban district where, you know, they can use that same rhetoric.
Right.
But, so it was really about choice and, you know, parents being able to choose what's best. But Colorado can't have for-profit charters, but you can still make money off of a charter management organization. We approved a charter that you have to pay $100 per student per year just to use the guy's name in the charter.
Okay. And so to be clear here, you can have a charter management company that will do multiple charters across the state. They get a fee from a not-profit, so
Correct.
They profit. It's just the entity of the school doesn't profit.
Correct.
So I imagine what they do is they set up these sort of almost shell organizations that are not-for-profits that are associated with the management company. The management company is sure to get the contract because it just so happens that all the same people sit on the board of the non-profit as the for-profit entity, and it's just really they're making their money just through fees as opposed to profits at the end of the year.
Right, right. There's absolutely ways to make money off of it. So money's, of course, always the motivation in these situations. And while we're a strong school district, we have seen what this has done to our schools and to our kids. And so we have fewer kids who have been National Merit Scholars, and we've got more schools on improvement plans, that kind of thing. We've saw a mass exodus of teachers, turnover of principals. It's been really destructive to our school district, but we've won the last two school board elections, and so we now have ProPublic Education school board members.
Is that a new tactic by, I mean, the local unions? I mean, did it just not occur to you guys? Like, hey, we need to get control. Was there just not enough sort of urgency, or I mean, why were they able to take it over in 2009, and why have you been able to sort of wrest it back control?
Right. Great question. And you're right on target. When they came in, our membership had a hard time believing that someone would run for school board who didn't want what was best for kids.
Right. Why would you run for school board if you wanted to destroy the schools?
Right. So our union leadership at the time told us, listen, this is scary and we need to get involved and we need to win these school board elections. And while I listened and some of my colleagues listened, not everybody did. And they thought, oh, you're being, you know, Chicken Little. The sky is not falling. Settle down. It'll be fine. We had never paid attention to a school board race. We never thought that we really needed to. So it took several election cycles to educate our membership and then go on to educate our community about what was really happening. And people thought we were crazy and they thought we were conspiracy theorists, because it's pretty hard to swallow the idea that people are coming in because they want to make money off of the kids and they don't really want what's best for our entire community. So it took several election cycles for people to become aware, and then it took several more election cycles to be able to fight this huge machine that has so much money and these unlimited resources, and be able to invest in our school board elections.
Did the work that you did in terms of convincing the community that, hey, there's a problem with this takeover of the school board, and then organizing to actually take over the school board, did that lay the groundwork for your ability to do a walkout?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We now have a community who understands the importance of public education and will support us in our efforts. And some people were really concerned if we walked out and closed our schools down that parents were going to be really upset. But it was exactly the opposite. Our parents know that we walked out for our kids, not on our kids. And our walkout was a single day. It was a rolling walkout of 2 days across the state. But it was just one day because we couldn't walk out and stay out. Our legislators can't raise taxes anyway. Even if we walked out for 3 months, nothing would change. So it was really just to raise awareness, but we had great support from parents. We had parents help us. It was very grassroots for our local. We bought all the red t-shirts in the county and surrounding counties from all the hobby stores, and we ironed on logos on it, and we had parents coming in and ironing on logos and picking up packs of t-shirts to take back to the teachers in their schools, and then walking with us when we went down to the Capitol.
That's great. And so, and let me ask you this, is your local union doing anything that further integrates the union apparatus into the fabric of the community? In other words, is there any, are you guys working on other people's issues?
We are working together with our community on the funding issue is our biggest thing that we're working with, and we're partnered in that effort with the NAACP and Padres and the Colorado Education Association and many other organizations. I think there's about 25 organizations that are working together on that funding issue, because everything comes down to funding. What's best for our kids with special needs, what's best for our rural schools, what's best for our students of color, all comes down to a funding need in Colorado. So we're partnering with them for that. And then our local is doing some work around mental health support after traumatic events like school shootings, mm-hmm. because Colorado, as you probably know, has had a very disproportionate number of school shootings and other mass shootings. In fact, my family has been in two school shootings.
Oh, gosh. I'm sorry.
And thank you. So we personally, as a local, have taken on that issue, and we're presenting a resolution at convention for mental health care for teachers and staff after shootings or traumatic events.
And is there, I mean, I get, is there a talk, though, of, because one of the things that, you know, and teachers, I think, have an advantage insofar as developing these relationships with the communities, because parents want access to you, or
right.
parents are trusting their kids with you. I mean, you have like a, do you feel, I mean, in terms of like, you know, and obviously the theme of what's going on here in many respects is post-Janus. What are the implications? I mean, Janus, does that impact you guys in Colorado in any fashion? I mean, what is the status of collective bargaining in Colorado?
So Colorado is not right to work, but it's also not a collective bargaining state. We're kind of in the middle, and we have local control. And so Douglas County lost our collective bargaining agreement. We don't have a collective bargaining agreement, and no one at the state level would intervene when we were losing that. But our neighboring districts do have collective bargaining agreements.
So when you don't have collective bargaining district, it's just basically the school board says, you're going to get X number of dollars an hour. Take it or leave it. Bye-bye.
Yep, that is absolutely it. And we have this wacky pay system that they call market-based pay, but it's more akin to supply and demand, but with no data to back it. And so our first, for example, a first grade teacher is valued higher than a second grade teacher because they claim it's harder to find a first grade teacher than a second grade teacher. And a high school English teacher makes less than a high school Chinese teacher.
Great.
It's
of
pretty,
course. That sounds ridiculous.
Yeah, it is ridiculous.
And I assume that's the case with all the other working conditions and grievances. They set up a system, that's it, take it or leave it,
exactly,
and that's it.
Exactly. And when we had the reform board in control, they literally would say, if you don't like it, you should leave.
Wow.
That was their attitude. And now we have a pro-public education school board, but it's hard to reverse a lot of those policies. So back to your question about Janus, we aren't a fair share state. So we're not losing fair share dues payers because of it. But of course, we're in this fight with our brothers and sisters across the nation. So it absolutely affects
us. Do you find they're looking to folks like yourself to figure out, like, what do we do now?
Absolutely, because we are always organizing. We are always talking to potential members about why they want to be a part of the union. And so we're talking to people across the nation about, this is your new normal.
Right.
And this is how we've always done it. And I think it's really ultimately going to be a good and positive thing for the union movement. I think this is just a minor setback, but Douglas County can show, it's our story shows, that you can beat these big money forces. We did it through our school board races, and so it's just another version of the same fight.
Well, Callie Leyba, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks. All right, Michael, I think we're going to have a couple other guests in just a moment.
Sounds before then? Or
what's,
no? Go ahead.
Say that again?
I was wondering if we were doing a bit more sound, or you got them right lined up.
Let me see. I think we have we have one more coming right now.
Come and, right up, unions, law. I'm ready to go. Do you see?
Exactly. And this is Ed Allen. Is that right?
That's right.
All right, Ed Allen. He is the president of the Oklahoma City.
Oklahoma City AFT.
AFT. And so you guys also had a very busy spring. Tell us how your strikes, is that, I mean, guys talk about, you call it a strike or not necessarily?
Well, it really wasn't officially a strike. It was a walkout. You know, when your employer says you're free to go and there won't be any problems, you know, so we were doing a favor for our school districts to get additional money. So really a walkout rather than a strike.
Okay. So, all right. So walk us back. What led up to this? What were the conditions that caused you folks to go on a walkout?
Well, I think Oklahoma had the steepest education cuts over the last decade, so the frustration has been building. We have Republicans control all levels of state government. There isn't one elected Democrat, statewide Democrat, in the state of Oklahoma. So the no tax philosophy of the Republicans had really, gained a foothold. So, but all the movements across the country, from Me Too to the students in Florida, and then West Virginia happened, and so, man, it was just, the conditions were just right. So that month leading up to that walkout, there was virtually no way we weren't going to do it. Even though the legislature came and right before the walkout said, here's an average of $6,000 pay raise, people were just ready to go, hit the streets.
Now, maybe 49th in the state in terms of pay?
49th.
49th in terms of pay. Before we get to sort of the other things that you were looking for, once you got that $6,000 bump, before you even walked out, what do you do as, and you're in a right-to-work state, right?
Right. And but we do have collective bargaining.
But you do have collective bargaining.
Yes.
So you have the free rider issue. You've been dealing with that for a long time,
time. Okay. Forever. And
so basically, what has happened in what was going on in Oklahoma is now the national model in many respects.
Right.
You are obligated to represent everyone, every teacher, right, as a union. Yes?
Well, we're... at the bargaining table, yes, and we're going to get with our lawyers and kind of reassess, but we've told our non-members, if you're willing to join, we'll help solve your problem. But if you're not willing to join, we're not obligated to help you. Now, maybe our national folks think that that's not a good legal position, but our lawyers in Oklahoma have always said, you're okay with doing that. So, but we're going to have to look at it again.
Okay. Let's put aside legal position. Yeah. I want to talk about more like a theory.
Okay.
Okay. Why? Give me the arguments that go around in your head as you start to, your lawyers say you could do this if you want. Put aside for a moment. Let's just stipulate that they're right legally. Why would you or would you not do it? I mean, because it's not as obvious. I mean, first blush, why am I gonna expend money to negotiate on behalf of people who won't sort of be part of the team?
Right.
But there's other arguments too, right?
Well, we get the part about we negotiate, for everybody, and we're okay with that. But when that non-member comes in and says, "I just got a reprimand or a bad evaluation, and I think they're going to recommend my termination." Now help me, our members and the local looks at that as, free riding, that comes up
right
immediately. And
so
our
we should
members
say it's not just the negotiations. It's very often the expenditures that's associated with reprimands or violations of the contract or whatnot.
That's right. And we've also had the experience of when we have said with some people, we will represent you. They say, oh yeah, I want to join now because I'm in trouble, and we represent them, and then a month after we win for them, they drop. So I have the conversation with folks, if you're willing to join, we're going to help. Most problems, really, we have a pretty good success rate. You're free to join, drop at any moment. I don't particularly care for the idea of someone joining just to get services
right,
and then drop. That just morally doesn't sound right. And when I have that conversation with teachers, they get that. And when people join under those circumstances and we win for them, we've pretty much got a member for life.
And so, okay. So tell me about how did the community, the state, respond? I mean, because you're going on strike after you all are walkouts.
It's hard to get away from the word strike.
You're taking a labor action. A couple of days after, they just offered you $6,000, and which is a decent bump. I mean, it's not. I don't know what percentage that, but it's not. If you were getting paid like you should have been, that's a decent bump.
Yeah.
But how did the broader community react to your going taking that action? And if it, and what had you been doing leading up to that moment that shaped the way the community reacted?
Well, I think the community was statewide, really, particularly in the urban centers, and maybe I ought to concentrate there. The urban, suburban areas really got the idea that we've got to do something about funding. You can't see the teacher exodus continue and not want to do something. They started putting pressure on their Republican legislators, their friends, to do something about that. So the whole mindset was changing, and really had been the views over the last year or two that we've got to stop the funding drain, the teachers leaving. We have to do something. So the walkout happened, got the 6,000 average pay increase. Community support was unbelievably strong. It exceeded my wildest expectations. So we were out 2 weeks. Now, we figured that 2 weeks was probably going to be pushing it, because here it is, it's in April and graduation's going to be a month away. And parents have to do child care arrangements for 2 weeks. So at some point, you'll start to see an erosion. So, although in those 2 weeks, we never did see it. But if it had gone a lot longer, I think we would have. But restaurants were bringing pizzas and sandwiches. It was just unreal. You know, when you get 25,000, 35,000, 40,000 people, day after day after day, it never let up. And other unions were great too. The AFL-CIO did shuttle buses, cooked every day for people, and non-members from across the state got to see what unions were all about. Uh-huh. Some of them didn't even know what the AFL-CIO was. And now they are taking them to the Capitol, bringing them back, feeding them. Boy, the outpouring from them was unbelievable, too. Okay, this is what a union is about, helping each other.
All right, so let me ask you questions about both ends of that. One, why do you think there was that level of support that even surprised you, and level of solidarity? Was it simply just because... I mean, and if it was just because of the state of education, what was it that had the general public have that level of awareness about it? And then I want to ask you, have you seen a rise in your union membership in the wake of this?
Well, let me hit the union membership first. We're up 15%.
Wow.
We had 300 teachers have signed up to help on political campaigns, and that was really not us going out and soliciting that was just almost all of it. People said, sign me up. And so that has never happened before in Oklahoma City. So we have a lot of activism. And going back to the first question, there were a lot of disappointment in our governor and the leadership and then the legislature. So that had been building up. So I think... it just led to a perfect situation for us.
Is there any talk amongst union membership for going out and sort of, to the extent that you had other support from the community for your endeavor, are you guys actively looking for other projects by other people in the community who are fighting that you guys can join in some way and add support? I mean, has that become a...
It hasn't heated up yet. We're involved in, there's a community forum in Oklahoma City with leaders of different groups and faith groups And so there's been a lot more talk in that organization about how do we work together in the longer term. You know, our teachers, many of our teachers were frustrated at the end of the 2 weeks because they wanted more. They deserve more, but the political reality that we were sharing with them, and at this moment in time, the largest tax increase in state history, getting 75% of our legislature, because we have to have a supermajority to pass a tax increase. Jeez. That was huge. And so it was a good down payment on what needs to be done, and now we have a Remember in November campaign to build upon our success. And so that community involvement and finding partners will continue to build.
All right. Well, I appreciate you telling us the story.
You bet.
And congratulations. I hope you guys do well in November, but certainly beyond there too.
We feel so confident.
Much. All right,
thank
great.
You.
Thanks very much. All right, folks. We got one more.
That was inspiring.
Guest. Yes, indeed. We have one more guest who's going to be joining me, and he is the president of Kanawha. I'm not sure I know where that is. It's in West Virginia, but we're going to find out. Have
Hello.
A seat.
I'm Fred Albert.
Fred, nice to meet you. We're live here, Fred. You're on camera. Those are the folks back in the studio.
Okay.
Hey. And are you good, Matt? Is that video okay? All right.
Looks good.
And so, Fred, you're the president of the AFT in Kanawha.
In Kanawha County, local 4444. Yes, I am.
Okay. So, I've just spoken to a leader of the AFT in Oklahoma City,
yes.
One in a county in Colorado. Both of them, the story starts with West Virginia.
Yes, it
did. So tell me, you start, when you're telling this story about West Virginia, where do you start?
Well, I start with it's been coming on for years. It didn't just start this year, but our members became tremendously, what word am I looking for? They became ready to do something, to take some action, because we've been under attack. Public education's been under attack across the country, of course. But in West Virginia, we had a governor who was elected as a Democrat, and before his first year term, he switched parties and became a Republican. But in his first year, he offered the teachers and service personnel a raise of 2% when we were in the red financially with the state budget. So after the end of his first year at his State of the State address, he offered us and he told us that our coffers were good, that we're now in the black and we have money. He offered us a 1% raise. And that seemed very strange to us. You know, when we had no money, he was willing to go 2%. When we do have money, a 1%. So people became disillusioned with our legislative branch and our governor. There were other attacks coming out. Attacks on seniority. Attacks on certification. So it wasn't just the money. One of the bigger issues was our health care. We have health care provided to us called PEIA, Public Employees Insurance Agency. And at one time, that benefit cost our employees nothing. Now we do pay a premium, but our co-pays have risen, out-of-pockets have risen, deductibles have risen. So that's a pay cut because Right. our pay had become stagnant. So we realized that something has to be done. And these broken promises and promises that are just really weird as far as go from a 2% raise to 1% raise, we wanted more. And we said, we've got to do something. And that was the impetus that brought us out of the buildings.
What? Give me a sense of West Virginia, its status as a right-to-work state, as collective bargaining.
We have never been a collective bargaining state. We did become a right-to-work state under this GOP legislative body about 2 years ago. And we fought and resisted and pushed back hard.
So if you're not a collective bargaining state, but you are a pre-right-to-work state, what does that mean?
Like, what that means is we have to go to the legislative body, to our senators and House of Delegates, and fight for every benefit that we get. They decide our pay raises. They decide to fund our health care. So that is how we fight. We don't have a need to negotiate with a negotiating team.
Okay, and so prior to right to work, though, how did that change when you became a right to work state? What changed?
Well, it didn't change so much for us as public employees or as state employees. It changed
for private unions.
For private unions.
Because you guys were already essentially without the ability to collective bargain.
Exactly.
Might as well be
Yes.
All right. So, what do you do in a situation like that where you don't? There's no compulsion to join the union. There's not even the images of 12 union negotiators going in with 12, state education negotiators. Like, it's all just sort of opaque lobbying and whatnot. What is the impetus for people to join the union, and how strong is it? And what's the state of the union prior to the walkout? And then
prior to the walkout, we organize around all issues that affect public employees and public school teachers and service personnel. So we're an issues-driven union. And we have members that realize that we're better together and we can accomplish things being stronger together than we can acting upon, as an individual. So our strength came from that. We get criticized. Well, you really don't have a union because, you don't need a union in a state like West Virginia. We feel that we do. We've always been a strong union state because of the United Mine Workers.
Right.
And we have a lot of union families that understand the benefits of belonging to a union and how a union can make it stronger for working families. So we've always had that culture in West Virginia of unions. But the benefits, I think our members have seen since the strike, we've gained over 1,200 new members. So our union.
What is that in terms of percentage?
That's a good question. I'm not really sure.
Okay.
That's statewide, so it would be. I don't know what the unit is statewide, but that's pretty significant in West Virginia, a rural, small state like West Virginia. That's pretty significant.
Has the experience changed the sort of the strategy of the unions?
It has, definitely, because how it has changed is we've seen an involvement of younger teachers and younger employees, service personnel who didn't really pay attention before, but the strike, the walkout, made them more aware. It made them more aware of the legislative process and what we have to do, and ultimately what we have to do at the voting box. So it has changed, and it's created an awareness and an involvement and engagement of members like we've never seen before.
I mean, I just spoke to someone from Oklahoma City as well, and they mentioned the ballot box. But I wonder, when you see the value of going out and withholding labor in this instance, does it begin to sort of like shape like, maybe we should be a little bit more trigger happy with this? Maybe that's the wrong way that sounds a little more out of control, but maybe there's a lot more value to this and a lot less downside than we thought. I mean, has it changed philosophically?
I think it has changed philosophically, and I think it's changed because we saw in West Virginia what we have caused to happen across the country. I think it's changed the labor movement. It has sort of given a booster shot to the labor movement. We've had support from the community like we've never seen before. We had community members bringing food to us, bringing water, visiting with us and standing with us on the picket lines. And I think it instilled in our members that sometimes we think the public is against us or they're not really supportive of us, but I think it showed that they are supportive in our efforts and that the working families will benefit from a stronger union throughout our state.
Had you guys been doing anything consciously to build more ties to the community?
Oh, we have. We're always community-minded, involved in our community, offering things to our community schools. Yes, we have done that forever. But I think prior to our walking out, we knew that we needed to have the community with us. We went to board meetings, to school board meetings, and we asked our board members to draft and sign resolutions that supported us. And that happened almost in all 55 counties of West Virginia, where the boards of education supported us through resolutions and what we were doing. And when you do that, then you're engaging the community, because right. the community's engaged in the Board of Education.
When was the last time that you folks had engaged in any type of labor
It was
action?
For teachers, it was in 1990.
Wow.
It was almost 30 years ago.
Wow.
Yes. And because we do not have a collective bargaining state, you know, it's actually illegal for us to walk out of the buildings. But we knew that
you're not legally protected, right?
It's no,
like sort
that's
of like
right.
somewhere in between. It's like
yeah. because we kept getting threats from our attorney general, who's a Republican, that he was going to get an injunction filed and force us back into the classroom.
Well, but
couldn't quite do that.
He could fire you without any legal implications, but then you don't have any teachers.
Then he doesn't have any teachers because we have over 700.
Well, so Fred, let me ask you this. So 30 years ago is the last time there was a strike.
Yes.
Okay. Is there a lot of institutional memory of that that's like floating around in your union? Like how
I wouldn't say there's a lot, but there is some. We still have some members who were there in 1990. We now have their children who are teachers. There is memory, and we try to keep that memory alive. I had just started teaching that year.
So you were at the very least but not necessarily from a leadership perspective.
No,
you,
I was a beginning teacher. But I did become a leader shortly thereafter because I saw the value of the unions and what the unions did during that strike. They came together, but this time was different because we did work together. We worked together with service personnel. We did not do that in 1990, but this time we did. It was all of the educational community working together with the support of the community.
Do you look back on the past 30 years and say, maybe we should have done this before?
Earlier? Oh, absolutely. Every day.
And oh,
I
yeah.
think, you know, why did we wait so long? But I think that speaks to who we are in West Virginia. We're a very trusting people. We try to work through the legislative process. We do depend on our legislators to work with us. And when we saw that wasn't happening, it was a long time coming. But you know, it's hard to go back and say, well, maybe we should have, but
of course,
this time we knew it was the right time. And we knew it was now or never.
Going forward, do you think it's going to be another 30 years before?
No, I do not. I do not. I think that we have engaged people, and we have our young, like I said earlier, we have our younger members who are going to legislative meetings, who are going to the interim sessions, who are going to committee meetings. They're watching what our legislators are doing. And we have more members running for office now than we've ever had before. And I think that speaks for their awareness of the legislative process. So I don't think we would wait another 30 years to take further action. I hear this all the time, and I say it too. I think we just started. I don't think we're finished, because we're watching very closely to what the task force is doing with the Public Employees Insurance Agency. That's not fixed yet. There's a task force created that was part of the concession, that this task force would look for a funding stream to fully fund PEIA. And we're trusting that they're going to do that. And if they don't do it, we're ready to do whatever we have to do.
Okay, so if you're looking forward and you're saying, whatever, the percentages of us having to get involved in another labor action is higher than it was before.
Yes.
Are you doing things right now that you hadn't done 6 months ago, institutionally, procedurally, in terms of building community ties? It's different?
Absolutely. I think, social media has helped us in that regards. We're keeping closer touch with our members, communicating more, keeping them active. We have members going all over the country actually speaking on behalf of what happened in West Virginia. So I think that we are looking for ways to engage members even further. That's happening throughout the state. There's a book that's been compiled with essays from teachers across the state. called 55 Strong. And that, I think, is also another avenue to keep this aware. Keep
and those essays what express like
of what happened.
Interesting.
During those 9 days and what will.
Where can people get a hold of
it? Yeah, it's online. So
55 Strong is
it? It's 55 Strong.
And 55 is?
Our counties. That's the number of counties in West Virginia. And we were all 55. The superintendents were with us, and they closed the schools in 55 counties so that we could do what we did.
Fascinating. Fred Albert, president of the AFT in Kanawha,
yes,
West Virginia. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate you. Thank
Thanks.
You.
All right, folks.
I thought you had your bat mitzvah in Kanawha, so I was
confused. I did not. That was not actually where. That's where we had the kids' party. And so, at one point, sooner or later, about let me just get a vague notion of when we're going to have Randy Weingarten, probably in the 2 o'clock hour. Okay, yeah. So I'll tell you what, Michael, why don't you do a segment with film guy Matthew. And then we will come back and we'll do some sound clips, and we'll stay. We'll do a Freebie Friday. This is like a throwback Friday to a Freebie Friday. Can I do that?
Whoa,
that,
man!
I don't want to
freak
boat,
everybody.
Bro. Freak everybody out. But that's what what's going to happen. We're going to do a throwback Friday to a Freaky, you know what I'm saying, folks. Hey, just a reminder, this program relies on its members. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com, sign up for a membership. It's just literally, I don't know, less than a cup of coffee a day. It used to be a cup of coffee, but coffee is skyrocketing. It's also why you should get justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off.
Coffee market's booming.
Yes. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Yeah. Michael will talk to Matthew Film Guy. I will stay here in Pittsburgh and await Randy Weingarten, the president of the AFT. I will be looking on Twitter. If you have any questions that you want me to ask her, send those along. And let's take a quick break. Michael will be back with Film Guy Matthew.
Welcome back to the Majority Report, back to Brooklyn. Joining us now, And do you have this ready, Matt? Give us a second. We just had a little bit of a difficulty because I called Matthew on the number we have set up in the system, and then he was messaging me going, no, the other number, almost to make me feel as if Sam was in studio. Do we have the song ready? Okay. Joining us now.
I'm sorry.
But before he can talk, we have obviously have to play his song, Film Guy Matthew Weiss. Matthew, I always get an image when I hear this song of you going into your room after your mom said that you couldn't borrow the car and just like raging. Like, is that accurate?
I had my own car.
Metallica
was in the days of, you didn't take me to the comic book store, Mom, why? Way before a car was relevant.
So you just got to it. You just sent me something that I don't even understand right before we went on air. But you somehow have gotten involved with some alt-right drama on Twitter. Is that correct, Matthew?
Yeah, it's weird. Thanks to the massive celebrity that I've accrued from my appearances on this show,
yes.
I believe that I was the victim of some sort of reverse, like, Zionist, anti-Zionist trolling. But I wasn't personally affected. I actually didn't even hear about this until I assume some intrepid member of the MR crew out there found it and asked me, is this you? Because someone took a picture of me that I had posted online making, like, a funny face in front of the lone protester right. at the Roger Waters concert.
Why was somebody protesting the Roger Waters concert?
Well, you know, Roger Waters has this reputation as being sort of a pro-Palestinian rights and anti-Zionist.
Oh, I see. So one rando person.
One lone angry Jew, Zionist, was out there saying, Roger Waters hates Jews, you know, as if it's the same thing. Obviously, they always conflate Jews and Zionists. So I thought it would be funny and clever to take a selfie in front of it and post the caption, self-hating Jew selfie.
And now, did you say it like that? Did you say it like self-hating Jew selfie? Like question mark?
Yeah,
or did you just say,
yeah, it was all in the punctuation. I had a question mark. Right. Yeah, exactly. I'm not, right. you know, it's irony. So, you know, and like
Matthew
Woody Allen would say,
Film Guy Matthew,
I hate myself. It's nothing to do with being Jewish. What?
I think you, in some ways, you're the original irony, bro, I think.
Okay, yeah. I'll take it.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever.
Right.
But so somebody, yeah, put some fake name, a fake Twitter account using that picture, which I assume was some sort of like, you know, get back at me for being making fun of this Roger Waters protester. But it said something like,
"No, I have it in front of me." It says,
"Did you put it up?" Yeah.
Well, it should be up. I don't know exactly what you're responding. You're responding to two. I mean, one of the accounts is Richard Spencer. So you're responding to a couple of. No. Okay.
Thank you, Matt.
Pardon me. So this is what you wrote. So this is the fake Film Guy Matthew Weiss account responding to a couple of fascists. And you do you want to let me just read to people what the fake you wrote?
Yeah, set it up.
Except that whites don't actually deserve a homeland. You have terrorized the planet forever. You should be enslaved and raped to death.
Okay, not me. Did not come from me. But what I
it
think
came from my show notes for a TMBS episode, though, on my answer to farm appropriation in South Africa.
Yeah, sure. But I think it is somebody who either listens to the show or knows me from the show as Matthew the Film Guy, because the name is David Holtz. I think it's a reference to David Holtzman's Diary, one of the films that I recommended at some point. It just sounds like a Jewy name.
That is such a bizarre...
It's like a QAnon.
Yeah,
like,
this is
connection.
So weird.
It's real inside baseball here.
At Never Again 0666.
The most obscure, like, inside MR baseball being harnessed to, like, get you to be the target of a frigging, like, alt-right digital attack. That's so weird.
Yeah, I mean, it never actually came back to me. This was somebody reached out and said, hey, this is you in this picture, but it never came to me. It was just I had my likeness appropriated, I suppose, to be I look like what someone assumes a self-hating Jew or a kind of rabid anti-Zionist would look like.
I mean, not really, to be honest. I mean, I think actually part of what makes this sort of funny is that, and it's terrible, nobody should do anything like this, but I do think it would be funny in a movie version if you became the avatar of the, like, you know, insurgent Nation of Islam style policies that we're really going to need to have. The face of anti-white America. No, of like global anti-whitism. And you just become the Pepe of actual white genocide.
That's none of my business.
Someone gives it to Farrakhan. No, this shouldn't happen. But anyways, in the comedy version, Farrakhan goes out and he's like, someone sent me a photo of this
white
Jewish
devil.
Brother.
Jew devil.
And I say brother because, and here we go. You ready for the flip? He got it.
Yeah. I was enjoying all the comments in this Reddit thread that are like, just look at his face. He never got laid. He wants black dicks in his ass. You know, all that kind of stuff.
Right. Naturally.
I'll just read one. Sounds like a closet gay with a rape fantasy. So
that was, look.
Hey, it takes one to know one, you know?
Hey, what? That was JP from Canada. No, I'm just kidding.
What? Oh, my God.
Sounds like a closet queer with a rape fantasy.
Don't they know how white genocide works?
All right, I got to go out on stage with Dave Rubin now.
You have to actually make babies.
He's another white phobic genocidal Jew. Whites are being exterminated and genocided. Jews are responsible for up to 100 million whites dead in Ukraine and Russia.
Wouldn't that be funny? And then next Joe Rogan appearance, you really sure about that stat?
Well, you know, that's actually a hell of a point. Might be 10 instead of 10 million. I like these two separate comics stacked on top of one each other. Here's one. And people wonder why the alt-right exists. Jesus fucking balls. The very next one is, Juden says what?
Juden says what? JP from Canada. Oh, is it? Sorry, I gotta get on stage with Ruben now.
You know?
Looks like somebody wants a black dick in his ass. JP from Canada. I like this Jordan Peterson Reddit character.
Hand me my fedora. Yeah. Yes, Jordan Peterson Reddit. Yeah,
he went
real
to,
stretch.
He went to Twitter, which is this devil platform, but there can be truth on the devil platform. And he said that the whites should be enslaved. Amen. I don't know if
some
you
Jews got it.
Some Jew. We played this clip on TMBS a couple weeks ago, where like Farrakhan was basically doing essentially his version of a kind of like intercept piece, or you know, this is unfair to the intercept, but of a character of an intercept piece, where he's like, Trump's attack. He said the FBI is full of liars. Get him, baby.
That sounds like the Farrakhan blaxploitation character.
He was in that mode. He had like a white tee on. He was sitting in a radio studio. He was definitely more in his kind of, he was, you know, people forget that Farrakhan was a, you know what Farrakhan was before he was a nation leader and became a leader in the nation in the 60s? And
no,
he was a calypso singer.
No shit.
He was a legit, and not, you know, and not like a big, you know, star, obviously, but like he had recordings. Like he was actually and also he's a classically trained pianist, but he was a calypso singer, and I think his family was from like the Virgin Islands or Saint Lucia or something. So he was a track star and a calypso singer.
Oh, wow! So here we have another kind of frustrated artist who goes into political demagoguery right along
some pattern. Yeah,
Bannon. Right, we got Bannon. We got Hitler. We got Sam Cedar.
Nice.
Boom. It's just a natural tendency for some people.
Boom goes the dynamite.
Although you're smearing Steve was a great artist. His West Side Story, Bloods and Crips, White Genocide film was before its time.
I told you that story about Steve Bannon's screenplay that my uncle had read as a reader for a development company years ago.
You told me off air, but tell the people. It's a good story.
I may have mentioned it once to Sam, but there was like this script that was like about a Islamic civil war, or like some sort of like terribly racist kind of concept that it got to be. My uncle said, like, people not only did they not want to make it, but it got passed around. It's like, look at this trash, how ridiculous this script is. And then it was like 8 years later, my uncle was like, that was Steve Bannon. That's this guy who's, you know, turned to the dark side, just wouldn't be accepted by the people who wanted him, and just said, I'm going to find will to power some other way.
I read Fire and Fury on a vacation, and it really is like, you know, if you're somewhere warm or whatever,
you really know how to chill out and kick back there.
Well, you know what's messed up about it is that on one hand, it's like you shouldn't be looking at any news and what you do on a vacation. But on the other hand, it's like that book is, I mean, you know, it's like eating a macaroon on Passover or whatever. It's like, it's like,
right.
It could not go down easier. Like, and so you blow through it in a couple hours, and I'm, you know, I don't care. Like, I think Michael Wolff was the perfect journalist to deal with the Trump era, and his I love his lack of journalistic ethics in relation to these people. But
I understand
some of his psychological, what kind of got missed is that some of his psychological observations about these people are really right on. And the first line he had about Steve Bannon, which was great, was that he was like a character in an Elmore Leonard novel, which is like totally true. It was really, really well observed.
Yeah, like a low life on the margins, trying to scam his way into something.
Right, but also with like serious anger and delusions of grandeur, and with enough savviness though that he actually could, more like almost like the Samuel L. Jackson character in Jackie Brown, a rum punch, like. You know, in his own, like, he's ridiculous and actually not, you know, really that, he's not like a boss or anything, but in his own little ridiculous world that he's created.
He overestimates his talents. He overestimates his intelligence.
But he actually does have some and is generally surrounded by idiots. That's what kind of makes those characters so funny. And then he kind of said,
that's how you feel on the show.
Exactly. Sure. And then the other thing that happened was, it was he said that Bannon could have just as easily viewed his life as basically like, you know, I grew up a working class kid in Virginia. I didn't have that many opportunities, but I went to the army and I got to Harvard Business School and I went to Wall Street. I made a decent amount of money and I don't have to worry. And then I got to, you know, I wasn't in the center of the action, but I got to be involved in some Hollywood deals and make some more money, and you know, like, you could be happy with your life, but actually his ego and his sense of himself made those that just sort of general upward mobile success infuriated him, because his conception was that he was a man of history.
Right. That's where the delusions of grandeur will get you.
Right. Are you teaching
I don't have
any
that
film?
Problem. I do not have that problem.
Are you teaching any film classes this summer?
Yes, I am. I have my wonderful, intelligent, inquisitive sexy elder Jewish ladies at the JCC in Forest Hills.
Are any of them actually, do you kind of flirt with like, ooh, Miriam, very, very astute observation.
I mean, I don't, but sometimes I do sense a few, like, I had one woman tell me, you remind me just of my ex-husband. Oh my God.
That's a funny one. That is a super Jewish comment.
Yeah. You could be his child. I mean, who was your father? Do you know who your father was? It was like that. It got that, like, explicitly genealogical.
When they don't
keep it real. Keep it professional.
When they don't know you're in a relationship, do they talk about fixing you up with daughters?
No, I brought Mary has come to the class, okay, so and the dogs have come to the class. They know all about my family. So it's all taken care of.
So you're clear out of the gate.
First of all, Mary would not allow me to portray myself as anything other than committed. So we make that very clear up front to interested elder Jewish ladies.
Cock.
Yeah, cock basically. And I'm fine with it.
A cock for whiteness. Cuck in relationship and much else.
Is there such a thing as cucking yourself? Because that's basically how I feel.
We've determined that cucking yourself is defending Elon Musk in a public forum. That you should immediately you should upload that onto YouPorn immediately.
Horrifying. Yeah. Thank you for that.
Have you seen Sorry to Bother You?
No, but it is definitely on my show.
Wow, this is actually, I have to find the music here. This is the first time.
I did look into the coup, though. The coup.
They're good. But this is the first time I've been cinematically ahead of you in my life, Matthew. Has anybody else seen Sorry to Bother You?
Not yet, but I plan to.
Matt?
Same.
I hear it's very good.
It is a... It's a very good movie. I mean, it's something actually that you have to digest a little bit. I saw it with Trevor, Ricky Rawls. We went out and saw it together actually, and it's a really good movie. And I think it gives you just enough hope. Like what I like is they sort of calibrated like. We don't just want to make I love on the other screen here. We have a screen of Skype that people, luckily for everybody else, they can't see of Sam about to like pound a fast food meal. Distracted me for a minute. I was like, I have my nosh.
I have my nosh in order.
Do you seek? Can someone minimize that? That's really disturbing. He calibrated like because, and I think that actually this is because Boots Riley is actually like a legit socialist. He, first of all, I mean, it's very astute on the kind of economics and striking, withholding labor power and stuff. But it's also like it's not one of these like bleak kind of lefty like, and the conclusion is it's all over. It's mm-hmm. like it's really, mm-hmm. really bad. And we should be under no illusions that like you know the yeah. good are on their back heels.
There's a fix right around the corner.
Yeah. But you know what? There's some openings here. And so you left the theater disturbed and disgusted and depressed and weirded out, also highly amused, and also like, right. There's some opportunities here. They actually pulled that off.
Well, that sounds right up my alley.
Yeah.
I like confused and depressed and disgusted with just a hint of, I think I could still live another day.
No, I think he did that. And it's kind of amazing. I mean, you know, he's obviously a talented artist and the coup has been around since the 90s, but you know, it's pretty mind blowing. I think it's a first time screenplay. How
awesome.
It's tight.
Awesome.
And I think David Cross and Patton Oswalt do the white guy voices. And they're
fun. Oh, really?
Yeah, they're
the
fun.
The dub over for what he does? That's funny.
Yes. Well, there's two. And I think I'm not sure the other actor, actually. There's another black character with an eye patch who I think I recognize the actor, but I can't place him. But he, I think he never speaks in his own voice. He's Patton Oswalt the whole time. I'm pretty sure it's Patton Oswalt. So,
well, I will see it, and I'm happy to discuss it on a feature segment with you.
So what are you bringing to the table for us today besides a really robust and honest call for white genocide, which I don't necessarily co-sign completely on, but I respect?
I mean, the white genocide thing takes most of my time these days, but I will.
Got to make those mixed race babies.
Jesus Christ, yeah. I can still see Sam eating. Yeah. God.
I saw an amusing tweet from someone, which is like, man, white people have it the best. Even their genocide involves like having sex with lots of people of color instead of like, you know, being murdered and gulagged.
I do like that. Yeah. It's like, yeah, well, how is this happening? Well, you know what? Leonardo DiCaprio got to bang Rihanna. So there you go. We're doomed.
If that's genocide, sign me up. Bop, bop, bop.
Yeah, that wasn't very... Hey, listen, I don't want to go on a rant here, but if white genocide means that I got to crack at Beyonce when she finally leaves Jay-Z, sign me up for it, Chachki. If white genocide means Brad Pitt's sneaking out of the back of Robin Givens' house so Mike Tyson doesn't break his jaw, I think that's a genocide we can all get behind. Bop, bop, bop.
Yeah. Those are the last two black celebrities that he's familiar with.
Yeah, right. I don't know. DiCaprio might be too recent.
That's true. He's just a teenager in that Gilbert Grape movie.
Right. We have to find, if we want to go on this, we have to like find out who like Harry Belafonte was dating in 1971 or something.
Exactly. Ask Farrakhan.
I'll get right on that.
I wonder. Well, I wonder if Farrakhan's thoughts on that. Film.
The movie that I actually wanted to talk to you about. Actually, I have two, but one of them is more available. That I actually wanted to talk about is maybe somewhat relevant to this because it features a relationship between Paul Newman and Rachel Ticotin. I don't know if any of you remember who she was, but she was Melina in Total Recall with Arnold Schwarzenegger. But earlier in her career, she was in an awesome late 70s, early 80s movie called Fort Apache, The Bronx. You guys ever heard of this movie?
I have heard of it, yeah.
It's an awesome snapshot of like the sort of late 70s degradation of the New York sort of cityscape, but it takes place in what is portrayed as like the worst police precinct in New York City at that time in terms of crime. And it has a small but memorable role by Pam Grier as, of course, a prostitute. And
Pam Grier is a very good actress. I'm thinking now, really going good. Back to Jackie Brown. Brief tangent. I rewatched that recently, and it's also amazing how that is the most... Quentin Tarantino treats her almost like reverentially in that movie. It's pretty interesting. Yeah, that was cool. That movie really holds up. But anyways, go ahead.
So Fort Apache, the Bronx, is Paul Newman is kind of a semi-alcoholic kind of down on his luck, a police officer who's been demoted, and he's in this precinct in the Bronx that they call Fort Apache because it's like it, you know, beset on all sides by the natives, which are like the blacks and Puerto Ricans and all the people of lesser means. And it's just like an interesting kind of story because it's somewhat of just like a character study, but it also has what you think is kind of like a serial killer plot to the center of it, but then it kind of falls apart in a weird way. It doesn't have a kind of it's sort of like one of the last 70s movies, you know, like before things got a little bit more 80s sort of slick and kind of with a sheen to it. It has all on location photography, so it's really got a snapshot historically of what the Bronx was looking like at that time. And it really toys with you as to who you're kind of rooting for. I mean, you're always rooting for Paul Newman, but you have him going against his police captain, played by Ed Asner of, like, Mary Tyler Moore fame. Mm. And he's sort of like an ambiguous character. Is he kind of a self-aggrandizing, power-hungry guy, or is he really trying to clean up the city, the area? And his relationship with the nurse, played by Rachel Tipitin, is like, they're kind of like two damaged people who kind of find each other, and it's like, but it's enough. It's very emotionally complicated in a way that a cop movie today just wouldn't bother being, because it would just be about who they get and a bunch of quips. But it has a lot of really, you know, entertaining set pieces. And I think anybody who's a fan of the kind of the HBO show style of crime film and crime show, Sopranos and so on, would find a lot to go with this movie. But you'd also be challenged just ever so slightly. So this isn't one of my normally completely downer movies, although it does kind of end on a kind of atonal note. It's actually a really sweet movie, and I think one worthy of being rediscovered by anybody.
It sounds great. I would love to see this. I also want to ask you one more brief tangent. Have you seen ads for next week? It's going to come out on Netflix, Sacred Games. Have you seen that at all?
No, don't even know the title. What's that all about?
That was a 2006 novel. I forget the author, but they're going to serialize it. It's basically about a Sikh police detective, I think in Bombay, who has to... He starts basically getting these calls from this, like, notorious Indian gangster who's based off of a real figure, who basically ends up sort of like... tells him his life story, and it's well written and interesting, but it's sort of, you know, in the beginning it's kind of confusing, like, you know, why is he doing this? And then it sort of culminates, like, there's a terrorism aspect to it, there's a God aspect, there's an India aspect. It was a pretty interesting novel, and they're actually serializing it on Netflix, which
sounds great.
I'm really excited.
I'll definitely
about
put that on the list.
Yeah. All right, what was the other pick?
And so one of my all-time favorite movies, I think one of the great unheralded masterpieces of independent cinema, is just getting re-released in theaters coming up this week, and I assume it will then be released on Blu-ray and streaming.
Yeah.
It is the only film directed by the actress Barbara Loden, mm-hmm. called Wanda. And it is criminally underseen.
When did it come
basically
out?
Basically, 1970.
Okay.
And it's about a woman who kind of is a passive figure in her own life. It starts with her agreeing to a divorce, and her husband kind of complains that she doesn't take care of the kids and doesn't ever come around, you know, sexually. And it's just like, I have to get out of here. She's just like, fine. And then she kind of bounces between these men that kind of take advantage of her. Hmm. She kind of falls in with like a petty criminal, and it sort of starts to sort of become like a heist-ish movie. But it always stays in this kind of ambient tone of, like, she never has any real agency. So it made a lot of feminists angry at the time, because it's not quite like a polemical feminist movie, but it does kind of portray the human condition in a way that is not ennobling necessarily, but the truth it tells, the way it kind of portrays the way we allow ourselves to be used, the way we kind of abdicate our own agency. It's really got that sense of, like, oh my God, this woman is, I mean, it's a maddening movie in a lot of ways, but it's also just brilliant. It never tries too hard. You know, she has a lot of cool quotes. Let me see if I got one here from her about the way she made the movie. She said, I really hate slick pictures. They're too perfect to be believable. I don't just mean in the look. I mean in the rhythm, in the cutting, the music, everything. The slicker the technique is, the slicker the content becomes, until everything turns into formica, including the people. And so I tried not to explain things too much in the film, not to be too explicit or too verbal. My subject matter is people who are not too verbal and not aware of their condition. And I that's the end of her quote. And I find that so appealing, because what normally passes for great movies or great characters are the clever characters, the people who get one over on somebody, the people who are slick, the people who have mastery or virtuosos of one kind or another. It's an easy way to kind of create like a, you cheer for the person. It's the, I think, the more serious films that are trying to be something a little less flattering of the audience to get them to, out of their $15 or whatever, that go for something that's not quite as polished. And this movie is that in spades. You know, she's a kind of a working class. She comes from like the mountains of Pennsylvania, and she's never portrayed as somebody who you'd normally find at the center of a movie. But it's by that exact token that I think this movie is so awesome.
Is why was it the only? This is barely even. I was going to ask you why was this the only movie she ever made, but it sounds like you just explained it.
Well, her whole yes and no. Her whole story is actually pretty tragic. She was the wife. She was an actress in her own right. She was in. Her husband was Elia Kazan, who was a very famous director, in the crowd, and
Splendor in the Grass. Didn't Kazan collaborate with McCarthy though? Is that true?
Well, yes, he was also a stoolie. Right. Yeah, he also sold out a lot of his fellow commies.
Right.
But this and so she was his wife, and apparently he like kept her down. Like while she was still an actress that could be in his movies, he was cool with her. And but when she became a filmmaker in her own right, and this movie like did well at festivals, and she kind of had a career started. I mean, yes, it was not a commercial huge hit, and it wasn't the kind of filmmaking. She was sort of like a female Cassavetes, basically. She was making these small, personal, challenging films. But apparently, the backstory is that he kind of sabotaged her career and was not comfortable with her being sort of an equal. She tragically died of cancer only 10 years after this movie came out. So you can draw your
that's really quite depressing
spiritually there.
Right.
Yeah,
right,
it is.
Right,
it is. But
and another mark against him.
This movie is triumph. What's that?
And another mark against him, frankly. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. He was a son of a bitch. Yeah. That's really, I mean, he made some interesting movies of his own, but none of them went for the kind of, the frequency of artistic truth that this one did.
Right.
And so we're left with this one great example of her genius. And
Blu-ray?
It's been buried and resurrected a number of times, but it's now coming out again this week.
Ooh, and what's the name of this movie again?
Wanda. It's the name of the main character, Wanda, by Barbara Loden. It's going to be playing at the Metrograph, all you New Yorkers coming up, so check your local listings.
Well, maybe that's and another then movie film. Date for us, Matthew.
Yeah, I'd love it.
Oh. Yeah, that sounds great. Okay, we're going to get going. We're going to get back. But I would just like to say, obviously, you have a lot of work to do. You have, octogenarian Jews to talk to movies about, and you also have to push forward the essential work of eliminating the white race.
The white race.
So thank you, Phil.
All right.
Matthew, as always, as you know, I'm playing my part in that. And
kill yourself. Kill yourself, you white devil.
That's right. Kill yourself, devil. Obama. Obama 2012. Kill yourself, devil.
KYD.
I was talking with some devils in Ohio. They're complaining about lack of job opportunity. Here's a solution. Kill yourself, devil.
Don't boo. Kill yourself.
don't boo. Slit your wrists. All right. Film guy Matthew.
Later,
it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Find my goddamn Bible flashcards. That's the last thing I'm going to say.
Well, Brandon's out of office, so sorry.
All right. He's on it.
Sorry, Joe.
See you guys.
All right. Allahu Akbar.
All right.
All right. Bye.
Allahu Akbar.
Okay. Back. Sam, you there?
I am here. we're going to get to Randy Weingarten's probably going to be here in about 20, 25, 30 minutes. In the meantime,
more
and,
sound.
And I just want to clarify. Well, I want to talk about some sound, but there was also some pretty big news that broke just as we went on air. 13 indictments of Russian intelligence officers in absentia. We'll get to that in a second. I just want to clarify this thing about Matthew Film Guy, because I only caught part of it because I went and got something to eat. Is he now a meme for the white supremacists?
No. The opposite. Somebody did a meme where he advocates for white genocide.
Somebody made a fake Twitter account using his likeness.
Which is actually really messed up. They used his likeness, and the tweet said something like, whites don't deserve a homeland. They deserve to be enslaved and raped.
To death.
And to death. And all of these, and it got on these white supremacist like Reddit threads, and they're calling him like a self-hating Jew and a cuck and all that stuff, and saying he wants to, have sex with black men. You know, all of their obsessions.
Which, to be fair, when we talk about white genocide, that is not what we're referencing. Just so everyone knows, the alt-right concept of white genocide is the idea that whites and non-whites are going to interbreed together and make a mongrel race of non-white people. So when we joke about white genocide, that is what we are referencing.
And I see. I see.
I'm referencing killing them.
Like when George Chicorello Marr tweeted, "All I want for Christmas is white genocide." That's what he was referencing. He didn't literally mean that he wanted all white people to die.
Look in the mirror, George. Got some work to do.
All right. Well, all right. So let's get to this news, because this seems to be pretty substantial.
Yeah.
Particularly,
was this the
Rosenstein
conference? Is that what it was?
Yes. Oh, okay. That's my understanding. Okay, yeah. So, and I've gotten, I don't know if we've had more response to any show that we've done in an extended period of time than we did from the interview with Marcy Wheeler. And she also had a post actually following up our interview that you know, we've spent a lot of time in the studio, and I've had conversations with people trying to figure out who the person is, obviously, that she had the source that she burned, and assorted elements about this. Now, she had predicted on the program 2 days ago that there was going to be a big that we were going to see some big indictments between now and really the end of this month. 2 days later, not even, there's this 12 Russian GRU units. I mean, these are Russian intelligence agents. Now, of course, look, these people are not going to, they're not going to go on trial in the United States. You do this because you are creating a predicate, right? These are the, there are a dozen Russian military officers. They're accused of being heavily involved. I don't know what that means, heavily involved, in hacking computer networks of the DNC and Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign organizations. Remember, this is what people were putting on YouTube with question marks, like, why is Seth Rich dead? Right? Because he supposedly stole these emails.
You tell us, Sam.
Well, I mean, those people, honestly, now, I mean, if you did one of those videos and you don't in any way come out with some type of apology or correction or, I mean, I suppose you can sort of be in denial and just assume that these indictments are also sort of like fake, right? That all the work that the Mueller investigation has done has been just to trump up these charges against these 12 Russians.
You're just doing useful idiot stuff. I mean,
I'm suspect of that. This is that that to me, this is red flaggy all over the place.
Red flaggy. they broke into systems and others in the United States to plant malicious software, steal emails, nab other documents. Apparently, they set up a fake Act Blue page, too.
That's interesting. Wow.
Called Act Blues, and
we'll kill Act Blues.
They attempted to penetrate Act Blue, according to someone I'm reading on Twitter who's from Act Blue. I guess they had never announced that before. The newly indicted Russian military officers communicated with two Americans during the 2016 election cycle. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein said he noted the indictment does not allege those two Americans knew they were communicating with Russians, nor does it state any U.S. citizen committed a crime. It is, Rosenstein said, the indictment is not a signal that the Russian operations changed the outcome of the election. Trump has been briefed on the indictments, which explains why
I'm so cranky.
I'm so cranky. Cranky.
How about instead of a briefing on my world collapsing around me, I destroy Theresa May's day? I mean, she's like a two. Who cares? Let's do it.
Apparently, there's some sound from Trump. he says, I will absolutely bring that up. I don't think you'll have any G. You got me, he told reporters. I don't think you'll have any Perry Mason here. I don't think, but you never know what happens. But I'll be very firmly asked the question.
Go kill yourself, devil.
I'm going to put my angry face on.
Nice.
Do we want to talk about Trump in the UK briefly before you...
Oh, yeah. Yes. I mean, there are major demonstrations happening right now. And
I got pictures of the big balloon, too.
Yeah, then there's a big balloon. I mean, he's... The hate for Trump is in full effect.
This is important because we know now that they are... the military officers created DC Leaks and Guccifer 2.0, however you pronounce that.
I think that is
it. Marcy Wheeler is tweeting that Marcy Wheeler was tweeting that we're about to find out that the operations were much wider than have been reported. The attempts to specifically attack Clinton's organization much greater than reported in the past.
I have to say, and this will really piss some people off. Sorry, no, go ahead.
Well, hold on, too. And just remind you that you've got this Ron DeSantis, and this came up in our conversation with Marcy Wheeler. He's running for governor of Florida, and he received stolen information directly from a Russian intelligence agent that he probably did not know, right? And used it in his campaign. This could be one of the Americans that they alleging was communicated, and they didn't realize they were dealing with, you know, a Russian intelligence officer. But,
right,
you know, I mean, I still hear people saying, like, this stuff is, it's not like it was fabricated. Well, it was stolen private correspondence. I mean, in Watergate, that's what Watergate was. Watergate was Republican operatives breaking into...
Nixon wanting transparency?
Yeah, Nixon, right. Nixon was like, yeah, I'm tired. Right. The DNC operates secretively. We need to give the people information.
I mean...
Because
honestly,
they rigged, because George McGovern rigged a fucking primary because he wants war with Russia.
Matt, I mean, you would know more than I if it ever existed. Was there anyone who ever made the argument like, well, they broke in, but it was not like they were fabricating information. They were just releasing it.
No, I don't think they got to that defense at any point.
Also, they're equating too. It has nothing to do with, like, nobody's questioning. I mean, I am... very suspect of Julian Assange, but I still would never want to and ever legally implicate WikiLeaks for doing journalism, and I have no problem with people reporting on what was stolen. That's separate than the crime of stealing it. Those are two different things. Why would you equate them? If you're serious about journalistic transparency, why would you put on a continuum an argument like that, which actually validates like the worst overreaches of the Obama administration of trying to equate those things? Why would you do that?
Yeah, it's absurd.
I mean, also, I have to say, this is what I was going to say that would piss people off. Not only wasn't it fabricated, it was actual information. And I, blah, 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 loathe the Clintons, support Bernie. But, like, if they were going to fabricate it, I bet they would have put out some things that were a hell of a lot more damaging and explosive than a bunch of frigging boring pedestrian emails, which is basically all it was.
It did reveal the stuff about Pizzagate, though.
Oh, that's
that
incredible.
Was good
that's
to get
true.
Out of the way.
That's true. But we already knew about that.
And what else? There was the only other thing that was interesting is apparently around this time in July, Trump wrote a tweet. The new joke in town is that Russia leaked the disastrous DNC emails, which should never have been written. Stupid, because Putin likes me.
I don't know if that's ha ha ha.
That's a good one.
Yep, solid. Sometimes the truth is funnier than satire.
Such a total, seriously total joke.
I heard a really good one about me wanting to have sex with my daughter the other day.
Did you hear that incredible one about me having a pee party on the black guy's bed in Russia? Did you hear that incredible routine about me working with the mafia in the 80s and 90s? Did you hear the thing about my dad bailing me out with chips at a casino? Ah, so much good humor.
So funny. So funny. You can't even write this stuff. It's so funny. All right. So let's talk about Donald Trump in Europe as we speak. There is a huge baby blimp flying over somewhere over Donald Trump. I agree with the popular sentiment that
so
if the blimp does not have the ability to defecate on the people below, that it's not true to form. But
it captures his essence, though. This is the closest thing I've ever seen to a full likeness to Trump.
You know, I had a conversation the other day with a neurofeedback psychiatrist. I don't know exactly, but he said, you know that Trump is not a sociopath because he cares so much about what people think of him.
Right.
That he's not, he can't be a sociopath because he, you know, a sociopath.
I'm an amoral narcissist.
He is the narcissist.
Get the distinction.
That's right. And that's what he said. He said he's a narcissist.
Yeah, there was never no cold-blooded sociopath in history being like, I think they like me. I mean, I know I like them. Did they like me?
He said he kept talking about the election for a year and a half. Like, he couldn't get over it.
Right, like a good sociopath would be like, yeah, I won on a technicality. I don't care.
Exactly. Like I don't even care. It doesn't even matter if I lost the election. I am president. Who cares? Come and get me.
I'm not going to do an amateur diagnosis, but I would say, like, if you're looking for public American politician, like, Dick Cheney is more in, like, the sociopath range. Like, I don't care.
Right. No, of course not.
Yeah.
All right. So we also have some sound from Trump in. Trump was in a meeting with Theresa May. And do we have this audio? Matt?
Oh, the meeting audio?
From the Sun?
Oh, I can look for that. That's not in the sheet.
Oh, well, that's big news. Super big. Apparently we did not get that text message that you said, okay, good. he's looking at it now. I can see him on. This is fantastic. I want to have this Skype contact. I want to be able to see Mike and Matt in front of me.
This is
your authoritarian leanings here, Sam.
I just got the Strzok interview part of that. I thought the Sun interview was Strzok. So.
Peter Strzok was interviewed by the Sun? Man, he's all over the place.
Matt. I wish we could put the feed that is on Matt.
Well, because I'm holding my tongue right now.
That sounds to me like Michael just sort of waltzed in at like 12:15 and was like, oh, what am I going to do?
Quarter of 11.
So
get your facts
right. Well, let's.
It's important to be precise.
Okay. Well, all right. So. Donald Trump is in Europe. He trashed the EU.
NATO.
And NATO.
Well, I meant in addition, yes.
Right. Yeah. And as he's about to meet with Theresa May, he gives an interview with The Sun, which is a Murdoch paper. And he basically just craps all over her. And one would imagine that, you know, for most politicians, that would be sort of a gift, right, from heaven. Like, oh, my God, Donald Trump is attacking me. Everyone hates Donald Trump. Everybody's going to love me. But as Michael and I were talking before the show today, Theresa May has really made it a project to show that she's both kissing his ass and, like, she's going to be the master manipulator of Donald Trump.
Right.
Doesn't seem to have worked. However, so
can't
Donald Trump had plenty of advice to give to Theresa May and said basically, like, if she does soft Brexit, like if she gets super, if she doesn't do the full Brexit, then any deal with us is off. I mean, who knows what to make of any of that? But I do know what to make of this. Donald Trump was there, and he is lamenting. In fact, he is lamenting. If you want to hear the basis of what Donald Trump is saying about the culture in Europe, simply Google white supremacists talk about the culture in Europe. And you will find a bunch of white supremacists are basically saying the exact same thing as Donald Trump.
Or better yet, listen to your interview a couple months ago with Christian Piccolini.
Right.
Where he's like, all of our introduction rhetoric to Nazi groups are what's coming out of this White House.
Yes. And here is Trump in Buckinghamshire. I don't know if this is a no-go situation where he was allowed to get into Buckinghamshire. They had to drop him in some type of military transport. But here he is talking about the problem with culture in Europe.
But I think that's very much hurt Germany. I think it's very much hurt other parts of Europe. And I know it's politically not necessarily correct to say that, but I'll say it, and I'll say it loud. And I think they better watch themselves, because you are changing culture. You are changing a lot of things. You're changing security. Look at what's happening. I mean, you take a look. I mean, look at what's happening to different countries that never had difficulty, never had problems. It's a very sad situation. It's very unfortunate. But I do not think it's good for Europe, and I don't think it's good for our country. We're, as you know, far superior to anything that's happened before, but we have very bad immigration laws. And we're doing incredibly well, considering the fact that we virtually don't have immigration laws. We have laws that are so bad, I don't even call them laws. I call them, it's just like you just walk across the border. You walk across the border, you would put one foot on the land, and now you're tied up in a lawsuit for 5 years. It's the craziest thing anyone's ever seen.
Jesus, but I think all right. He's so stupid. He is so stupid, man. God, Jesus.
Look, he's lying, obviously, about our immigration laws. It's nice that he thinks we're so far superior than others. The idea that things in Europe have not been bad in the past, I think you would need a very limited awareness of the history of Europe.
That's what Dad said. Dad said things were not bad in the past from a European perspective. He said particularly in the 30s, there was a lot of good things happening.
Well, and also the late teens and early 20s, a little bit tough in Europe as
also
well.
Also a tremendous time. It was great.
And, you know,
you remember, dark ages. You remember the phrase, trains ran on time? Everybody remember that phrase?
Honestly, like if you were to pluck some 14-year-old white supremacist out of like some Reddit thread and put them in that exact same situation, they would be, I want to say they would be less articulate, but they would be exactly as articulate.
No, it would be like a racist kid who didn't do his homework. I don't even call it laws in like Europe is super bad now.
This is insane. I mean, like he's, and there's just another level of insanity that is going on here. That is, I mean, you could attribute it to maybe he's cranky because he's traveling overseas, or maybe he attributes it to the fact that now he's got this meeting with Putin that everybody's calling to be canceled because they've literally just indicted, 12 intelligence officers for getting heavily involved in trying to influence the election. Now, I mean, my presumption has always been that we do this in some fashion, right? We certainly, our fairly recent history is quite clear on this. But you also got to imagine, like, if Russia had evidence, I mean, there's no opportunity really for, like, Americans, CIA to sort of influence the outcome of a Russian election, because it's sort of a foregone conclusion,
right?
In some respects,
right?
Certainly, we do this and have done this in other countries, and if other countries got mad about it, I would completely understand that.
Venezuela is mad about it right now.
Indeed. And I would be also very suspect of anyone who was elected under such auspices, right? I mean, right. So it's perfectly reasonable for us as a citizen of the United States to have a lot of concern about the guy who is elected under that type of circumstance.
What we oppose us doing overseas, we can object to having done to us. This is not hard.
Yeah, right. I think you can be against both those things.
Yes.
Simultaneously. And so Trump is, I don't know, maybe he's losing his crap because of this. I mean, my speculation is that if he's going to fire Mueller, it's going to be in during the lame duck session, right? Because
yeah.
He's probably getting a lot of pressure to not do it in the run-up to the election. Because that would put, I would think, Republicans in a rather uncomfortable situation.
But all the more reason you got to elect Democrats. Because if he does that, I mean, if he does that, you know, if Republicans are still in charge, there'll be absolutely no accountability. And then we go into a much more accelerated level of we're just jettisoning those institutions, period.
We got some of that sun sound now if you want to listen to it.
Yeah, okay. So here is Donald Trump. He lands in England and is going to meet Theresa May there's a point for all these diplomatic missions are supposedly to work things out and to maintain the quality of relationships I don't know. I think it's very hard for like normal people to sort of imagine that the fate of countries rests on some level, you know, I don't know what percentage, but on just the actual personal relationships between leaders, right? I mean, it just seems too petty.
You're really missing something here. Everybody's missing it. Theresa May, when I first met her, never said that Ivanka was a piece of ass. Got off to totally the wrong foot from the beginning.
But from
talk about personal relationship.
But at the same time, look, Donald Trump is a reflection of this country.
Yep.
And, regardless of the fact that he didn't win the popular vote, other countries would be ludicrous. They'd be irrational not to look at this and say, like, hey, this is this. Maybe Donald Trump doesn't capture, you know, the essence of America as, you know, and the spirit of America or even the majority. But this is indicative of a highly unstable country that they have a system where this guy could end up being president.
Right.
And so when he lands in England and then immediately undercuts Theresa May, it's damaging.
If you can't handle me at my best, you can't have me at my if you can't have me at my worst, you can't have me at my best.
Here is Donald Trump doing an interview with Rupert Murdoch's The Sun just literally hours before he's going to a formal dinner. Or no. He gave it before, but it came out just apparently as everybody was leaving the dinner.
Thank you so much, Donald.
Reporters could see everyone on their phones reading it and listening to it. Here is a clip of that.
I would have done it much differently.
Pause it. Oh, I should say he's talking about Brexit, and he's talking about what Theresa May, how she's handling Brexit.
I would have done it much differently. I actually told Theresa May how to do it, but she didn't agree with it. She didn't listen to me. I think the deal that she's striking is not what the people voted on. It's a much different deal than the people voted on. It was not the deal that was in the referendum. If they do that, I would say that would probably end a major trade relationship with the United States.
Wow. Thank you so much, Donald. I appreciate it.
I mean, this is pretty amazing. I mean, do you remember when Netanyahu came to the States and just, you know, the Republicans just invited him in?
Yep.
Can you imagine Netanyahu showing up just, you know, with an actual invite And then just, you know, the first thing he does, he lands, he gets off the plane, he goes to, you know, the New York Post and says, you know, Obama, he's doing it all wrong.
He was born in Kenya. Where's the birth certificate?
Well, it's almost like if he got here and started criticizing John Boehner.
Yeah, actually, that would be more analogous. Like, right. John Boehner is totally, he's so bad at his job.
I told him how to do it. I told him, what are you doing? But he didn't listen to me. But he doesn't listen. He's messing up on military, but
and then
also
later,
on trade.
Later, apparently in that interview or prior to that, Trump was saying, like, I knew there was Brexit was going to happen. Barack Obama did not get it right. I got it right. I was right about it.
There are four pillars. Approval, fuck my daughter, deal with Russia, undo Obama. Those are my lodestars.
He talks about it like he's placing bets on it, mainly.
Yeah. All right. Lastly, there was this exchange. Now, this is interesting for two reasons. One, clearly Trump is extremely agitated, right? I mean, he's extremely agitated.
Oh, yeah.
The Theresa May interview may very well be part of that agitation. Like, he is not controlled in any way. He's exercising no self-control here. And that element, keep in mind as you listen to this clip. The other element you should keep in mind, when Barack Obama had moved Fox News at the beginning of his administration to the back of the room in the press pool, in the White House press pool, literally to the back of the room, because they said, you know, your opinion journalism. The rest of the media, CNN, I remember in particular, was incredibly self-righteous and protective of Fox.
Oh, God.
Which, of course, it's like, I can see you doing that for fellow journalists, but...
But Fox is Fox.
Yeah, they're not. There's no integrity. Now, of course, now Jake Tapper et al. Are saying, like, why didn't Fox stick up for us? They're saying this on Twitter. And it's just like, but here is the exchange where Donald Trump is, Jim Acosta is asking Donald Trump a question, and Donald Trump will have none of it.
Mr. President, since you attacked CNN, can I ask you a question?
John Roberts, go ahead, John. No. John Roberts, go ahead. CNN's fake news. I don't take questions. I don't take questions from CNN. CNN is fake news. I don't take questions from CNN. John Roberts of Fox. Let's go to a real network. John, let's go.
Well, we're a real network too, sir.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you.
Some people.
You knew just what I was when you let me in.
But it is amazing that the guy from Fox was just like, and can I clap your chalk erasers?
Is it really?
Yeah, is it
anyone
amazing?
Well, surprised?
That's exactly what I would expect.
It is. You know, is it amazing? Broadly speaking, I don't think Fox would have a different attitude, but you always think that there's a 50-50 chance that any given individual is actually not a horrible human being and would respond to that. Certainly when it was the tables were turned during the Obama administration, and of course the Obama administration never said, you know, this fake news and didn't do that publicly in that moment.
That'd
but
be so awesome. Well, I don't take Fox News questions. They're fake news.
It's not about their individual morality though, right? Although they probably are all terrible human beings. Like, there are power structures in place that make it even less likely that they're going to criticize Trump.
Well, like I say, there were the same power structures were theoretically operating under the Obama administration, right? And CNN et al. Now, this one individual might be like, I could never do this because I'll get fired or whatnot.
Well, actually, I have a question about that. Do you
think
maybe he just doesn't want to get a bunch of death threats? I think that's another dynamic at work. If I undermine Trump here in England with my audience, I will be terrorized by these people.
I think with a moment to reflect upon it, you would have that reaction.
Right, but it was right there. Yeah, you're right.
In that moment, it's just like he can ask Like, I feel
right.
like...
No,
I feel
it was like just like, total cutting the line.
I mean, look, totally. I would be... I certainly understand, like, I'm afraid of this whole situation, but I can't help but think just sort of like reflexively, you go right. like, oh, yeah, he can ask. I'm good. You know, you could just like say like, oh, I'm okay. You know, like, but.
I like how uncomfortable Theresa May looked, though. I did enjoy that. She was just like, oh, dear God.
Just let it go, Donald.
Here we go.
Donald, just answer, please, the CNN question. His trip has already been really quite delightful. Maybe there could just be one moment of semi-normalcy. You know, for my whole career, I thought that I wanted this job, and I was plodding towards it, and it's really turned into an entire fucking mess.
I hope we can all agree, like, Fox is not a legitimate news organization, right? Like, it's
totally.
A propaganda arm of the Republican Party and
actually,
the powerful interests they represent.
Did you ever read Sam's book, though? There's a chapter called Like It or Not, Fox News is a Legitimate News Organization.
That was the one that the editors were like, are you sure you want to do this?
We may disagree, but Fox News is legitimate by Sam Cedar.
Alex Perrine and Jake Tapper went back and forth a bit on this. On
oh,
Twitter.
That's cool.
Oh, did they?
Yeah. How did that go?
What is it?
Yeah.
Can you?
So I'm putting it up here. Basically,
send me the link.
You. 1 second here, Michael. Do you want to read?
Okay.
That?
So do you want me to start Anna Marie Cox or Alex Perrine? Okay. So Jake Tapper goes. Old enough to remember when our networks came to the defense of Fox News White House correspondents during the Obama years.
I saw that one.
Blah, blah, blah. And then I'll read it for everybody. Such did not happen here. Lesson for the kids. There, no one should ever try to do the right thing with the expectation that it will be reciprocated.
Yeah, not for
Anna
Republicans.
Anna Marie Cox responds, but it underscores that the kids should learn to do the right thing just because it's the right thing. Otherwise, you wind up with a purely transactional view of morality with reminds us of some president somewhere. Then back then, oh, you got to move it because you put it in front of the pillar.
I got it. Okay. I mean,
yeah,
and then
this
Perrine
is Alex
goes.
Perrine. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, was it the right thing to lend legitimacy to an irresponsible and racist propaganda organ that to this day relies on the fact that respectable people treat it as normal news orgs, even as it goes increasingly off the rails into white nationalist conspiracy mongering? And then Jake Tapper responds, was it the right thing to stand up for the principle that a member of the White House press pool can't be frozen out by the White House? Yes.
Oh my
was it
God.
The right to ask why the White House why it's appropriate for any White House to attack the entirety of a credentialed news organization as illegitimate? Yes. And then Perrine says, it was professional courtesy for a colleague that had the real-world effect of legitimizing what is actually an illegitimate outlet. Maybe the White House doesn't get to make that call, but real, actual, respected journalists should. Your friends who work there shouldn't work there. And then Tapper says, so a question asked at an off-camera gaggle had the real-world effect of legitimizing what is actually an illegitimate outlet? That's insane. Moreover, how does that compare with Obama doing a Super Bowl interview with O'Reilly? Now, here's the interesting thing that Tapper has now sort of flipped to making Perrine justify Obama's acts as opposed to addressing the actual issue.
That's the move all the time. I mean, everything is what did Obama do or what did you say during Obama by everybody. That's the biggest cop out
Piers
in the world
Morgan
now. Yeah, that's yesterday. Piers Morgan from yesterday with, I forget her name at the moment.
Ash Sarkar.
Ash Sarkar, yeah.
I mean, they messed up. The press messed up. I mean, they should not have empowered Fox at that time. You know, and the bottom line is, yes. Are there decent journalists there or were there at that time? Maybe. But understand, that's like saying, hey, you know that that coffee shop that's a front for the mafia? They actually sell coffee. So,
Mamma
I
mia,
mean,
this is so unfair. We make an espresso.
Like, honestly, it's like you know, that you know, the Bada Bing, yes, it's mafia owned, but they really do strip there. I mean, they're real. The strippers are real.
You know, those girls work very fucking hard to be professionals, and you undermine the whole freaking thing when you talk about our operations. It's very disrespectful.
I think the hopefully the lesson learned is you have to make an assessment. the journalists, you know, and this is not terribly dissimilar from what I was arguing during that Mike Hull Cernovich thing, was if journalists cannot make these assessments, who can?
Right.
Right? Like I can understand why Omaha Steaks decides that they don't want to advertise with me anymore because they're nervous and they realize, like, oh, we don't want to get involved in politics. We're a, you know, company that sells steaks. I don't have the ability. We don't have the tools here to determine who Mike Cernovich is or whether Sam Cedar's a satirist or whatever it is. I mean, that to me is understandable. But when you are a media outlet that has literally millions of dollars that you in resources to find out the truth, theoretically, right? Like, you have to make these assessments.
That's sort of your job.
It's
actually your core brand
proposition. Yeah. Indeed. And so, I mean, that's a massive failure, it seems to me.
Also, there's nothing wrong with Obama going on O'Reilly's show. It's just what he should have done is said, kill yourself, devil. It's my message to you. And by the way, all your viewership.
Well, folks like Jake Tapper are still trying to pretend that they are A, neutral, and B, they're just like two sides having a debate. And, you know, it's not like one side is destroying the world. It's we got to be civil above all else. The two sides, the center right, the center left.
I think Perrine nailed it when he said it was professional courtesy, because this really is more about careers. And it's really more about, like, I don't want to be out of a job someday, and I need to, you know, it's like, I don't know, somebody described to me the Sirius XM, the business model there was like to where you have like middle management and upper management hire a ton of people so that when they know inevitably they have to make cutbacks, they'll be able to do it, still maintain the same level of efficacy in their jobs, because
we're really cutting back.
It's capitalist efficiency.
That's the great classic example of how capitalism operates in such a more efficient way, not to mention humane.
All right, let's go. We've got some more sound here.
Okay, what's the is?
Well, let's talk about the. I'm still waiting to hear about Randy. If it doesn't happen while we're live, I imagine it should happen. We'll do a recording afterwards. Cool. But I was actually, frankly, very happy to talk to some of those.
Those interviews
were
great.
All right. So meanwhile, now this is a bit of a side show, but it is a show. Peter Storzak, Storzik, he was the head of counterintelligence. I think he's been reassigned. He was on the, Clinton and Trump cases. He apparently was having an affair and was, text messaging, the woman he was having an affair with, who also worked at, in the FBI. And the guy seems to have a very cynical perspective on a lot of politicians, including Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And he has been relieved of his duties on the Mueller investigation for over a year. And I will remind you that Donald Trump has been president for about a year and 5 months. So...
Long time.
A lot of stuff has theoretically happened over the past year in terms of that investigation. Yet, the Republicans, they think this is their, this is going to motivate the base in some way, or this is going to provide. I actually don't think this is going to motivate their base. It may keep some in line, but I don't think it's going to add some motivation.
Trying to kill the whole credibility of any of
investigation. Right. Muddy waters.
Muddy the waters.
It might motivate some fundraisers, too.
Yeah.
But the one thing I have to say that I walked away from these hearings, and I'm sort of agnostic about the Strzok guy. I mean, I think he did a pretty good job relative to the situation he was in. I think it was perfectly legitimate to take him off the, once it became public, you know, these texts became public, then I think it was clear he needed to go. But what I really stood out for me was it almost feels like there is some type of IQ test, if you will, that is administered to congresspeople when they come in. And they simply say, like, if you score below, like, a 60, you're going to be a Republican. And if you score above, like, 100, you're going to be a Democrat. Like, that was the one thing that came across to me, was like, my God, these guys are all dumb. And I also thought it was amazing how quiet Jim Jordan was. That was weird. But here is...
here yeah, is the documents.
All right, so let's start with Peter Zorzyk's... is this his opening statement?
Yeah.
Okay.
There is, however, one extraordinarily important piece of evidence supporting my integrity, the integrity of the FBI, and our lack of bias. In the summer of 2016, I was one of a handful of people who knew the details of Russian election interference and its possible connections with members of the Trump campaign. This information had the potential to derail and quite possibly defeat Mr. Trump, but the thought of expressing that or exposing that information never crossed my mind. That's what FBI agents do every single day, and that's why I'm so proud of the Bureau.
Gee, thanks a lot.
Yeah, I mean, all right, so that's his yeah. opening statement, but here is the guy who was investigating Benghazi for 14 years, it seems like. It was really, I guess, just like 7 years. Trey Gowdy, who is resigning, right, from Congress?
He's not seeking another term, as far as I know.
But gosh knows what he's going to be running for. Because he really, here is Strozek and Gowdy. This is the one time I thought Strozek was like, you know, getting passionate and angry with Gowdy. And this was relatively early in the hearings.
15 minutes. And your testimony is Bob Mueller did not kick you off because of the content of your text. He kicked you off because of some appearance that he was worried about. Sure.
My testimony, what you asked and what I responded to, was that he kicked me off because of my bias. I'm stating to you, it is not my understanding that he kicked me off because of any bias, that it was done based on the appearance. If you want to represent what you said accurately, I'm happy to answer that question, but I don't appreciate what was originally said being changed.
I don't give a damn what you appreciate, Agent Strzok. I don't appreciate having an FBI agent with an unprecedented level of animus working on two major investigations during 2016.
The chair recognizes the gentleman from Maryland, Mr. Cummings.
Oh, point of order,
Mr. Chairman, can I respond to
answer the questions that you promised him he would have an opportunity to answer?
Does
we endured 15 minutes of badgering of the witness. Can he be allowed now to answer as you promised, Mr. Chairman?
The gentleman will suspend. The witness at any time can ask for additional time to respond to any member's question if the time has been ended.
You said you were going to give him that opportunity at the end.
I am giving him that opportunity.
Mr. Chairman, may I respond to...
Yes, you may.
Yes,
you
got it.
Pause it for one second. Incidentally, it's interesting to note that, because that happened very early in the hearing, I think in the first, like, half hour. By hour 10, or even 7, the chairman, was not allowing Strozek to respond. And Strozek, to his credit, he seemed to respond to everything.
Right.
Like he, you know, in some instances, he said, FBI counsel has told me I can't answer that question because he still works for the FBI. But he responded to even non-questions, which I think was helpful for him. But continue.
At the end,
I am giving him that opportunity.
Mr. Chairman, may I respond to?
Yes, you may.
Yes,
you
got it. Sir, I think it's important when you look at those texts that you understand the context in which they were made and the things that were going on across America. In terms of the text that we will stop it, you need to understand that that was written late at night, off the cuff, and it was in response to a series of events that included then-candidate Trump insulting the immigrant family of a fallen war hero. And my presumption, based on that horrible,
disgusting behavior, that the American population would not elect somebody demonstrating that behavior to be president of the United States. It was in no way, unequivocally, any suggestion that me, the FBI, would take any action whatsoever to improperly impact the electoral process.
I think he did that perfectly. He's like, yeah, just the basic, obvious human response. And he's talking about, well, I think it was the Khan family.
Yeah.
There's so many of these things. It's like Trump's just this ending, unending stream of disgusting that we don't even remember that. But he demeaned a Muslim immigrant family whose kid died in Iraq. And he just was saying, like a lot of people said, I think from all walks of life, everybody from like...
That's the Raskin clip we're going to play.
Well, yeah, let's play that Raskin clip because, like you say, Strozek, and he brought up the Khan family. He said, let me tell you why I wrote this about Donald Trump, because he's a disgusting guy.
Right.
And everybody thought that at the time. He didn't go as far as saying, I still think he's disgusting, but he did say, like, he's a disgusting guy. Everybody thought it. And then Congressman Jamie Raskin from
Maryland,
he brings home that point quite well.
Those statements. In the spring of 2016, Senator Ted Cruz called Donald Trump a, quote, sniveling coward, a pathological liar, and a serial philanderer. Was this attack on Trump by Senator Ted Cruz a coordinated part of a deep state conspiracy that you organized?
No.
On August 8th, 2016, Senator Marco Rubio said Donald Trump was, quote, unworthy of being our president. Was this attack part of a deep state conspiracy that you organized?
No.
In October of 2016, Speaker Paul Ryan said, I am not going to defend Donald Trump, not now, not in the future. Was this fleeting outburst of moral courage part of a deep state conspiracy that you organized?
No.
Former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson called Donald Trump a moron. Former EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt said he's an empty vessel when it comes to the Constitution. Steve Bannon said he's like an 11-year-old child. General H.R. McMaster referred to Donald Trump reportedly as a dope and an idiot with the intelligence of a kindergartner. Karl Rove called him a complete idiot. Representative Duncan Hunter said he's an a-hole, but he's our a-hole. And the director of the National Economic Council, Gary Cohn, reportedly sent out an email describing Trump as an idiot surrounded by clowns. Were all of these vituperative negative characterizations of Donald Trump part of a deep state GOP conspiracy engineered by you and your friends?
No.
Were any of these statements part of a conspiracy you organized?
No.
Now, although this conspiracy does appear to be overwhelmingly Republican, if it exists, balance compels me to ask you about my hero, Bruce Springsteen. Unlike the others who are all Republican, Springsteen's a Democrat, and he said, the Republic is under siege by a moron. Did you tell him to say that?
No.
Was it part of a deep state conspiracy to criticize the president?
No.
Mr. Strzok, this hearing has been a circus and a kangaroo court run in banana Republican fashion. And I believe that some of my colleagues have disgraced themselves today in their attack on the FBI and the justice system of America. How can we recover from the hole that has been dug here today?
And apparently Raskin did not think that Strzok had the ability to answer that question. I mean, it's well done. I mean, this is all just, like I say, this is a bunch of kabuki theater. And the question is, there was the Republicans control the committee. Of course, it's going to get attention because it's a show. Nobody really knows like what the relevance of any of this stuff is. You know, in the final analysis, impeachment of a president is a political process. Period. End of story. Right? Like everybody has this fevered dream that Mueller is going to walk in there and throw cuffs on Donald Trump. That's not going to happen. He's going to deliver a report. And then after that, it's really going to be about the political process. And in many respects, the Republican Party has been gearing up for this fight by making it a political process now. And they know what their game plan is. We're going to undercut this investigation even before it has its conclusions. So This is a sideshow in terms of getting to the truth. It is not a sideshow in terms of accountability down the road.
Right.
And so these performances by Strzok and by the Democrats are relevant. Maybe not for the Trump voters, for the Republicans, but it's relevant for, you know, frankly, the people in the middle who don't pay attention to too much. And when, you know, push comes to shove, you know, are they going to hear, what are they going to hear about this? And that's why this stuff is important, because they're building a political, I don't want to say case, but they're it's a political campaign. And ultimately, if there's any accountability for Donald Trump, it's going to come in this context. Unless he loses in 2020, and then I imagine he'll just go to prison shortly after the first trial.
Nice.
And that will be fun. That will be fun to watch. All right, we have one more piece of sound.
Free
from
Lula and prison Trump. The rallying cry of
so
our times.
I think what's going to happen is
it.
I think what's going to happen is I'm going to end up doing a pre-tape with Randy Weingarten. I'm going to record her, and then we will play it at a future date because she's tied up, I guess, in meetings. But in the meantime, Louie Gohmert, who, you know, we were so ahead of the curve on Louie.
That was insane.
On the Russia thing.
That was nuts.
That was before me.
That was before
yeah,
you.
We were so ahead of the curve on the Russia thing. We just thought it was Louie Gohmert.
Yeah.
Not Donald Trump.
We thought
Louie
Gohmert.
We missed it.
Yeah, we thought Gohmert was the sleeper cell.
Yeah, now people don't realize that Louie Gohmert studied in, I think, what was then the Soviet Union.
Yes. He spent a summer there or something.
Spent the summer. And comes back, and then all of a sudden has this very heavy Texas accent.
Right.
And that almost seems fake. It's like, right. Seems like it's so over the top. And, you know, I don't know if you ever saw the movie Silver Streak, which was Gene Wilder and, oh gosh, I can't remember his name now. One of the most famous stand-ups ever.
Richard Pryor.
Yeah. And they were trying to sneak by some police who was guarding the train stations and the airports, and they were trying to sneak by. And they said, like, the way you do this is you're loud, you be big, and they don't pay attention. Maybe I'm getting that confused with Young Frankenstein. Nevertheless, it doesn't matter. It's one of those type of movies, and it's quite possible that's what Gohmert's doing.
Yep.
He's just getting so big that people just, they have to look away and don't realize that he's part of a sleeper cell. Like,
Louis, act even more stupid.
In fact, Strzok was the guy who ran Operation Ghost, which rolled up all of those individuals who were in the United States that, like, the Americans was based on.
Mm.
The people who had been in this country for, in some instances, decades. And were actually Russian spies. Strzok was the guy who rolled that all up.
So
now,
he and Gohmert might have nearly crossed paths before, is what you're saying.
I'm saying
yeah.
That's possible.
Yeah,
and maybe Gohmert is just, like, mad because all his friends are gone.
Right.
So here he is.
Hey, you know, everybody's got political views. Those are called biases. And we all have them. And you have come in here and said, I have no bias. And you do it with a straight face. And I watched you in the private testimony you gave. And I told some of the other guys, he is really good. He's lying. He knows. We know he's lying. And he could probably pass a polygraph.
Point.
It's amazing.
Mr. Chairman.
No, this is my
Mr.
time.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry.
It needs to
point
be
of order.
Paused.
This point of order.
No.
The general state is point of order.
A member of this committee just asserted that this witness, who is under oath and a former agent of the FBI, lied. There is no evidence that. I ask him to withdraw it.
I do not withdraw it. He is not a member of Congress. It's not a violation of the rule. And just as you have been expressing bias through your members about what a hero
there is, not a single person on this committee who has ever characterized a witness.
Gentleman from Rhode Island. Gentleman,
it's my time.
That's a disgrace.
Gentleman from Rhode Island will suspend
him. No, the disgrace,
Mr.
what this man has done.
The gentleman
to our
from Texas will suspend for a moment.
There is the disgrace. And it won't be recaptured anytime soon because of the damage you've done to the justice system. And I've talked to FBI agents around the country. You've embarrassed them. You've embarrassed yourself. And I can't help but wonder, when I see you looking there with a little smirk, how many times did you look so innocent into your wife's eye and lie to her about Lisa?
Mr. Chairman, this is outrageous.
The credibility of a witness
shame
is always an issue.
Mr.
Chairman, this is intolerable harassment of the witness.
What's wrong with that? You need your medication.
That should be on Louis Gohmert's tombstone. Needed his medication.
Yeah, indeed. So, I mean, this is, you know, this is a show for a lot of Republicans. They want to bring this home, and this is the way that they're going to get their base out, and they're going to win their elections, or they're going to fend off a primary, or whatever it is. I mean, this is that's what this is about. This is like a showcase show, you know, that they're all going to get their opportunity. And that's, I mean, but again, it's a sideshow, but it's one that is laying the foundation for the main show that's coming. And that is going to be the question of impeachment, or if there is enough pressure to impeach people or not. So we'll see. All right, let's play one more clip of sound, and then I'm going to drop off and go and hopefully record Randy Weingarten. We'll play this interview sometime in the next week or two, indeed. But before we get there, this is Angela Rye. She's
CNN contributor.
Right? I mean, I don't know what her.
I think she was a strategist before. I think she worked for Congressional Black Caucus, but now, you know, she's primarily a media personality,
right.
CNN analyst contributor.
And who is she on with? It's
I recognize Jolly. He's a former Republican.
Oh, right,
congressman,
right, David Jolly, right.
Who
right.
now is and a critical of Trump. I don't know the other two.
Yes, and there's another woman who is a, you know, I think a conservative talking head, and Angela Rye. She can't quite take the gaslighting, I think, is basically what it comes down to. Check this out. We'll pick it up right after. I mean, I guess right as the Republican shill is sort of covering for the white nationalism.
Right. Hitler, are you going to vote for him? I mean, that's what I don't get.
That's a far-fetched hypothetical in my view, Don.
But I'm saying what you're saying.
Pause it for 1 second. So just to clarify, what she's talking about is there are multiple Republican candidates around the country who are avowed white supremacists. And the GOP is stepping back, but not all of the Republicans are stepping back in terms of support. And so Don Lemon's like, where do you draw the line? Like, how Nazi of a Nazi do you have to be before you lose Republican support?
I thought the hypothetical of would you vote for Hitler was one of those real give-me's.
Yeah. All right. Let's play this.
Party nominates Hitler. Are you going to vote for him? I mean, that's what I don't get.
That's a far-fetched hypothetical in my view, Don.
But I'm saying what you're saying, though, but it sounds like what you're saying is it doesn't matter who this person is at his core as long as he is a Republican. That's the point I'm trying to make. Mr. Jolly, do you understand that?
Don, I hate these conversations because it forces Republicans to confront a reality that I believe, which is this president is racist. And whether that is a result of some type of financial elitism, whether it is because of being born and on third base through white privilege, or whether it is a part of Steve Bannon's nationalism. This is why traditional Republican struggle with his leadership. We can't forgive it. We can't normalize it. We can't suggest that he can be the figure of a party that we subscribe to. It's heartbreaking. It's not an easy conversation. It sucks. Everything about it sucks. This is the president, and he is the leader of the Republican Party, and he continues to peddle what is very clearly racist tendencies.
I just want to say, Congressman, like, I wish that the new members, the folks who have followed in your footsteps, could at least acknowledge that. Like, that's all so many of us are saying. And at this point, I'm emotional.
And let's fix it.
Because we cannot. Like, it's like being constantly gaslit. We're constantly being told. I'm told every day I'm on air that I'm racist because I call out racism. That is maddening to me, and I'm crying about it because it's crazy. And I wish
and
that somebody who's a colleague of mine, like
it.
Alice, could at least acknowledge that fact. Like, that is so frustrating. We're supposed to be talking about a 12-year-old boy who is just trying to deliver newspapers, and the police are called on him in Ohio, where Tamir Rice was killed, and the same age. I want to be acknowledged and seen that this is not okay for our children. This is not okay for the future direction of this country. So I want to say, I commend you for saying what you said. It means the world to me.
Okay.
I mean, there you have it.
It's amazing. You just have this disgusting ghoul woman in the middle just staring blankly ahead while, you know, to his credit.
I'm sorry. I have a job to do.
Right.
I'm sorry.
I know this is really emotional for everybody, but I'm kind of here to do something.
All right. Well, look, I'm going to sign off. Michael, you want to take a phone call or two?
Oh, sure.
Or an
I'll
IM,
call into the system.
And
sure. We'll take a few calls.
And I will take a quick break. Don't forget, folks, check out TMBS this week.
Tuesday, Matt Taibbi's in studio.
Matt Taibbi coming up. Last week, it was Harvey Kay. And also, The Antifada, available at patreon.com/TheAntifada. Sleepy Hollow, the book on literary hangover this week. All right, I'm going to sign off. I'm going to record at least an interview with Randy Weingarten and then hopefully others. And I will be back in studio on Monday.
Hi, Randy. That's my impression of you greeting Randy Weingarten. How do you like the nosh at the teachers' conference?
The food has been great.
The food has been great. You never think of Pittsburgh as having great spreads.
Trump. Am I right? What are we going to do?
Trump.
What are we going to do?
But I'll tell you, we're going to make sure that we are not trumped by Trump. That I will tell you, Randy.
I'm coming up with a whole set of double entendres. And that's the way we're going to deal with Trump. That's the way we're going to deal with him. We won't be trumped by Trump. I'm not going to... how about this? Whenever he gets a good idea, I'm going to say, like, Don lights over Trump, right? Donald Trump. Don. Well, I got to work on him. They're not easy.
It.
They're not easy.
Do you ever see that Angela
no
Rye? Do you ever see that Angela Rye? She's so smart.
All right. I'm going to sign off.
Okay.
I'll talk to you soon. Right,
bye-bye.
See you.
Thanks.
Give him a shofar.
Okay. Shofar for Sam and his meeting with Randy Weingarten. For some reason, I have no idea what the problem is. I'm not able to get into the IMs, folks. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time trying to figure that out. But I will take two calls. You're calling from a 773 area code. Who are you? Where are you calling from?
This be Uchiwali.
Uchiwali. It is actually extremely good to hear from you, although I'm guessing that there might be some type of complaint or dispute.
No,
oh,
either.
Oh, beautiful.
To bother you. Last week, actually.
What did you think?
I thought it was awesome.
Yeah.
It was pretty fun, but I have this weird thing where I don't like comedies like Mate Pass after Ghostbusters. So the audience really laughed at everything, and I actually laughed a couple times myself, which in and of itself is an incredible feat.
Oh, wow. All right. I thought it was pretty funny.
Yeah.
You know what's funny? I think it was funny and it succeeded as a comedy, but it did not depend on, and I guess this is what you're saying, but it didn't depend on you thinking it was particularly funny to be a good movie, if that makes sense.
No.
Yes.
No, and the one scene with the rap, I won't spoil it for anyone. It's incredibly hard to get me to laugh that hard. That was some Dave Chappelle shit right there.
That really was. That's what I thought when I saw it. Yes, that definitely hit that Chappelle zone for sure. Everybody should see that movie.
It did.
It's a good movie.
Wait, so you?
Yeah, I give it a hard.
You like old comedy? Because my thing with comedy is I feel like there are some good old comedies that shouldn't be slept on, but usually comedy ages worse than other sort of forms of film.
I love like Blazing Saddles and Airplane. I'll tell two people are my two funniest movies ever.
Okay.
But anything like very few movies past Ghostbusters I think are funny. I like some of the Wayans stuff. And that's about it. I like absolutely hate Adam Sandler and the like.
Well, that's Will Ferrell, of course. That's a given. You know what? I'll do a Friday one. You know what? It's not that obscure, but it might be off people's radar. It's an early 90s comedy. What About Bob? That's a funny movie. And it's actually kind of
okay.
It's pretty bleak, actually.
It's dark AF.
Bill Murray and Richard Dreyfuss. Actually, that's like a legit funny movie.
I was way too young for that movie when I saw it.
Also,
I must
me,
say.
I was literally 6 or 7 years old in the theaters, and that movie has some wild shit. But what's
really
great
explains
is
a lot about us.
But it really. It builds up to the wild shit really well. That's actually a funny movie. It's a good, and a lot of, if you're, I guess, and even tangentially, if you're into The Sopranos, it's also basically therapy satire. Anyways, funny movie. What else was on your mind, my man?
Actually, that was it. I just want to tell everybody to get out there and watch that movie. It's pretty good. It's a high recommendation, and it'd be nice if everybody saw it this weekend so that it gets a good premiere at the box office.
Yeah, I have to say this is a good moment to be market oriented. Movies like this don't get greenlit that much. Get it some money so there's more space for artists like this and projects with actual political punch to it. So yes, get out and see it.
Okay, thanks. Keep up the good work.
Thanks so much, man. Take care. Let's see. I don't see it. Okay. You're calling from a 650 area code. Who are you? Where are you calling from?
Hey, is this me?
Yes, this is you.
Hey, this is VK from Australia.
Hey, what's going on?
Hey. So, I was born and brought up in India, and I lived in the U.S. for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, I just thought I would share some of the parallels that I see in today's Indian society and my experience in the U.S.
Okay.
So we have a more of a conservative right-wing government right now, mm-hmm. but similar to U.S.
Narendra Modi BJP government, Hindu nationalist.
Yep. Okay. Hindu nationalist is the right way to put it. Okay. And every time an election's around or anything of importance is coming around, you would always see Hindu-Muslim divisions flare up.
Yep.
And you would see Narendra Modi not actively supporting it, but not coming out and making any sort of statement or position against it. So kind of an implicit dog whistle.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a subdued version of what Donald Trump would do, but along the same lines. We also have a crony capitalism of the highest order going on in India right now.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe since going on since a long time, but it's very apparent at this point. Not as much as Trump, but a recent example of that would be some of the bigger corporate houses like Reliance, they get sweetheart deals and whatnot. And the right-wing government over there also uses soldiers on the border as a shield for every feeling and incompetence of the government. Does that happen in the U.S.? I think so. And a media which is never critical of the leaders and Narendra Modi has not held any direct press conference or taken any direct questions in almost all of his 3.5 years.
Well, and the other thing, and the other thing to add, we're running a little tight, but I just want to add really quick that, I mean, obviously there's specific differences in all these places, but there is a global trend here. There is Trump, there's Modi, there's Putin, there's Arben. I mean, there's political forces, obviously, in Germany and France. There's a very serious fascist threat and candidate in Brazil, even as right now there's a austerity government, which has been propped up by a lawfare coup, which has obviously imprisoned Lula. And so this is a global pattern. The other thing about Modi, which is really specific, and I actually wrote about this several years ago, was that when he was the governor of Gujarat, you know, at the very, 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 very least, he stood by and did not actively intervene in a basically a two-day sort of orgy of mass killing targeting Muslims that had killed about at least, I think, a couple thousand people in the span of literally about 48 hours, and some of the most intense atrocities that you could imagine. And there's also claims that, you know, it wasn't just as simple as looking the other way. There might have been there's accusations of deeper connections. In fact, because some Christians were also slaughtered, there was a period of time when Modi was not certainly before he's prime minister, where he actually couldn't get a visa to visit the United States because of that incident. So, yep, that's very dark. It's very bad stuff. And I appreciate the call, and I hope you'll call in again soon. Thank you so much. All right, folks, that's it for today. We have to run. We will get some more calls, obviously, on Monday, and see you then. Thanks, everybody. It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. Finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice was made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. Shifted in and out of gear, waiting for my moment to happen. I don't know how much longer I can stay in, or how much more I got to pay to play in. I know somehow the lines got graded somewhere before the credits faded, but my power.